We want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Mike Crossy, president of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, going to be here talking about the budget, what Corbett is doing to education, because today's going to be budget day pretty much the whole day as we look at what the next year is going to look like for the citizens of Pennsylvania, for the poor, the needy, since it is 2012, the year of the Bible. Did you see the speech today? Are those biblical priorities? Is that the morality of the state? Well, we'll be talking about that also with Kathy Jellison, president of SEIU Local 668. They represent a lot of public sector workers, a lot of public welfare folks, a lot of people who work in the departments across the state, the people who help the poor, the elderly. We'll find out how the budget's going to affect them. And also Steve Hicks, president of APSCA, the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculty, is going to be here talking about really the real loser in this is going to be college students. The real screw job at higher education. Wow. You know, at a time when they're talking about, you know, to get that next middle class job, to be able to pull yourself out of poverty, high school not going to do it anymore. I mean, the president during the State of the Union, I thought, you know, made a nice gesture saying we're not going to let people drop out. But in this economy, high school, that's the barest of minimums. You now need advanced degrees. You need higher education, and not just college, but also vo-tech training. We need to start going thinking, how do we get people the skills that they need to get the jobs that we have while continuing to have an education system that encourages critical thinking, you know, some thoughts, problem solving, you know, so that we can have active participants in our democracy. On the third hour, we're going to talk with Donna Cooper, senior fellow over at the economic policy team at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Going to be here talking about the transportation portion, what we should be doing, not just here in Pennsylvania, but across the nation to spur job growth. Because look, the Republicans know, Stephen LaTourette, the congressman from, Northeast Ohio, 42,000 jobs for every $1 billion we invest in infrastructure. That's his number. You can debate where it came from. I've heard 30. I've heard 35. He said 42. This is telling me that the Republicans even know that transportation's a win-win situation. One, you and I, we don't have to drive on roads that feel like the moon. And two, it puts somebody back to work and helps the local economies. They understand it. Why aren't they doing it then? Well, they're not doing it because it's all about November. At this point, it's all about getting Obama out of office so they can put their guy in. So we can go back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, early 90s of bust, bust, bust. I mean, because that's where they want to take us back to, the same horrible plans that got us into the mess we're in now. So all those folks, plus your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So today is Second Chance Tuesday for Rick Santorum. They're going to have their caucuses in Minnesota and Colorado, and you look at the possibility of 76 delegates up for grabs. Now the Romney camp has lowered their expectations. They're not thinking they're going to get any. It's kind of interesting to see that Romney's kind of you know, backed out a little bit, you know, after riding to, you know, South Carolina, Florida. Now you're looking at Minnesota, Colorado, not so Romney-friendly. I'm thinking Santorum may actually pick up most of these delegates. Now, Missouri also has their caucus today, but that's down the line. It's pretty much what they're calling a beauty contest because they're not going to have theirs until March 17th. So I'm not quite sure why they're doing this other than just maybe to have a party and, you know, have fun, I guess. But again, 76 total delegates up for grabs today. It'll be interesting to see what tomorrow brings us. Because the Santorum camp could sure use a couple of wins to get the money flowing back into their coffers. And it would be nice to see a race started again so that Romney may actually have to answer a question. Now, just before I came on air, I was looking at a series of pictures of Romney holding babies, and the babies just look horrified. So even there, he's a guy who scares babies. That's not nice. It's not nice. He's got a bunch of other problems. He doesn't need me adding that one on top of it. So today, the big budget talk, was it as dramatic? Was it as difficult? Was it as drastic as you thought, as Senator Joe Scarnati said it was going to be? Well, I found it to be pretty much in line where I thought it was going to go. You basically start off any of these speeches with the good pandering. You got to go to the hero types, to the military types, and then, you know, to a big local thing, you know, moment of silence for Paterno. You know, so you had to get that out of the way, and he did. And then you have to congratulate yourself on things you should have done anyway, like passing the state budget on time. Said we the first time in a decade we've done that. Hey, Tom, you should have done that. You had no opposition. Was it really that difficult? And if you remember last year, it was actually kind of difficult, even though there was no opposition. He goes on to say that we did not impose new taxes on our citizens. And I guess, you know, the key word being they're new. He did end up raising taxes on me and a lot of people around the state as our school property taxes, as our school taxes went up because they gutted almost $1 billion from education. Then he goes into the whole kitchen table argument, which, you know, hey, you got to do. You've got to set the stage so that people start feeling like, oh, well, you know, we're broke and we got to tighten our belt and we got to get ready for cut, cut, cut. And he did that nicely, you know, because this is all about priming people, just kind of, you know, greasing the path towards the pan. And you got to give him credit. He, you know, used a little bit. No sand, just a little bit of Vaseline there. So the kitchen table argument came out, we bring in money, we can only spend what we bring in. You know, that's something maybe we should have told Reagan and H.W. Bush and W. Bush. Just a thought, considering they're the ones who just exploded our debt problems and all the deficits we've had over the years. But then he goes into his list of accomplishments. And I'm sitting there, I'm waiting for the accomplishments. Here they come, the big ones. Tort reform, he claims. And this is the joint and several liability thing that they, and a real complicated, very technical thing. At the end of it, you and I get screwed. And his idea is, you know, by doing this, by taking the rights to sue away, and being, it's really a very technical thing, but by, you know, basically screwing you and me, that's going to somehow help the job craters. And I'm not sure how, but, you know, again, you're lowering the bar. You're making conditions in the state worse for the residents, for the workers, and a little bit better for business types. And, you know, you go back to the 90s, like I talked about yesterday with Tom Rich. You know, we're tearing down barriers. We're cutting red tape. We're eliminating taxes so we can be business friendly. Well, this is the Republican mantra. So that was the first thing that came to his mind. The thing that we did in this state, our big accomplishment was to help businesses with tort reform, or so they call it. Second thing, earlier today he said the legislation was passed creating these new Keystone Opportunity Zones. But wait a minute. That's not an accomplishment. You haven't done it yet. And what's it going to do? Oh, it's going to give more tax breaks and more economic development money to business? Oh, that's not helping me at all. It's actually taking money away from the pot, giving it more tax breaks for corporations. How is that helping me? It's not. So they've also said we're close. They're close. Another accomplishment. Here it is, another accomplishment. We're close to reaching a consensus on how to address the impacts of the Marcellus Shale region. Close. We're almost there, man. We're close. We're moving right in. He looks forward to signing whatever they come up with. And I'm going, that's it? Those are your accomplishments? That's what you did? And you didn't really do anything. And then he goes into this whole thing that he's taking credit for job creation that he had really nothing to do with. It was going to happen anyway. And then he panders to the folks in Philadelphia, which, hey, I mean, if you're him, you're going to have to. Because the project that was started during the Rendell years, you know, the dredging, you know, Tom wants to take credit for. And he pointed out that, you know, Philly was founded as a port city. Did you know that? Of course you did. But now we want to bring in these super tankers to port into Philadelphia. And a pair of new super tankers, I guess, are being built. And that's good. We need shipbuilding. That's great. But I, again, don't see how Tom could take credit for something that he had nothing to do with, really. So there you go. So what's he going to do? Well, he says right now. Right now we are hard at work to bring in major natural gas processing plant to Southwest Pennsylvania. They're hard at work, and we talked about this. We're basically in a bidding war with Ohio and West Virginia at who's going to tear who down and who's going to give the biggest tax breaks. And he says, according to him, the best argument that they can make to the company behind the project is that Pennsylvania embraces free markets. That's the best argument he can make. Now, I'm sure it's going to come down to these companies don't give a rat's behind if we embrace free markets or not. What they want to know are dollars and cents and how much tax abatement we're going to give them and how many services we're going to give them for free and all of that. That's what they care about. But to him, he, in his mind, somehow he thinks that equates to free markets. The fact that we're going to give away hundreds of millions of dollars and if not billions of dollars in tax breaks, that's free markets. And I guess in conservative world it is. But he talked about his action team. And I thought it was hysterical that two of the three companies he talked about, General Electric and ExxonMobil, are two companies that, to be honest, don't really pay any taxes. Kind of interesting. He used the example of General Electric. And he said, you know, our action team came to the aid of General Electric, which already employed 5,000 people at its locomotive plant. We made it possible for GE to expand and hire hundreds more at a new location nearby Mercer County. And I'm going, well, why is that they're expanding? Why is it that they're growing? There are a couple of rail projects going on across the country that federal money is being used to pay for. Could that be it? Because, again, nobody buys anything that there's no you don't build something that there's no demand for. So what did he do? Well, nothing. They gave some tax money. And I love his statement of, you know, business creates jobs where it feels welcome. And more of this, you know, this business-friendly nonsense. That, again, you know, just kind of blows my mind. And on the transportation front, he basically said, you know, oh, well, you know, it's important. But, you know, and it's been a long time, and nothing's been done for a long time, so we're going to ignore it for another year. That was kind of the best line of it for me. And then he goes on to say the demands of a mixed economy where free enterprise exists alongside government encouragement. I'm going, what does that mean? What does government encouragement mean? Does it mean public-private partnerships where the private interests gain all of the advantage and all of the profits? Because if that's it, yeah, he's on that path. And he's doing a great job. And he also calls for some new programs, Pennsylvania Incorporated. It's his Jobs First PA initiative, if you will. Then we're going to have a comprehensive job matching system, Keystone Works, and targeted industry certificate programs. So, again, you know, more programs that he claims we don't need more government, yet here another Republican is. creating, yes, more government. And finally, before we take a break, just so you know, we're going to continue to phase out the capital stock and franchise tax. So businesses, understand, Pennsylvania is very friendly. Kids, sorry, you're screwed. Quick break, back after this. You might start representing. Save the USA, it's drowning in crap and lies. Save the USA, and resume the time to mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the game.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Flight attendants from more than 20 airlines protested at Los Angeles International Airport Monday against what the union says is the latest attack on collective bargaining rights in the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill before Congress. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says Republican House leaders and Democrat Senate leaders are proposing drastic changes to the labor law that governs the airlines. The union says, quote, by requiring the support of at least 50% of an employee group before a union representation election could be held, where currently there is no statutory requirement, Congress is trying to undermine a worker's choice to have union representation, end quote. The Flight Attendants Union says the controversial labor provision is nothing less than an attack by the 1% against the 99%. The union likened it to attacks on collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin and Ohio. On April 25th, there will be a global teach-in, a town hall-style meetup on the Internet to lay the groundwork for creating a global network to advance the agenda of the world's 99%. Jonathan Feldman is an associate professor at Sweden's Stockholm University and the chief convener of the global teach-in.
We have to build up alternative institutions and deal with financing, job creation, and some kind of major investment in public works, infrastructure, and these alternative technologies. And so cutting the military budget, moving our money out of the established banks into alternative financial institutions, as well as selective reinvestment, by which I mean unions and other activist groups and consumers can move their money into networks that would create jobs. All these things will be discussed in the context of this global teach-in.
Walmart is once again being hit with discrimination charges. Nearly 500 female employees of the retail giant filed charges last week with the Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission. The filing comes after the Supreme Court declined last year the right of current and former employees to file a class action lawsuit due to the women working in many places under numerous bosses. The plaintiffs allege that women are paid less and promoted less often than men. By filing with the EEOC, the women start the process of filing individual lawsuits against the company. If enough complaints are filed, it could trigger an investigation by the commission. The Supreme Court simply said the plaintiffs couldn't file as a class action and didn't come down one way or another on discrimination. It is possible that multiple class action lawsuits can be filed by various groups of women. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I've got a golden chance to make my way. And with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
You know, if we could only get those wonderful vouchers, oh, life would be so wonderful. Or at least that's what I'm told. Every time I turn around, I'm being advertised at why we need to destroy public education, why we need vouchers, why we need more charter schools, why we need cyber charter. And you look at the numbers, you look at the facts. They're not doing as well as the public school systems are doing. Even though that, you know, their coffers seem to be full, and every time I turn around, I see that public school funding being cut, being cut, being cut. In today's budget talk, again, you know, you look at the numbers. Education Voters PA Susan Grabreski, her tweet of the day, loss of greater than $94 million. You look at $900 million last year, $94 this year. She said almost $1 billion in cuts. That's why I've asked Mike Crossey, president of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, to come talk to us about what he heard today and what the numbers look like and what it means for Pennsylvania's students. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
It's great to be with you, Rick, as always.
You know, I look at this, and what's frustrating, again, you know, we're talking about giving huge handouts to corporations, talking about doing away with the cap and franchise tax, but education seems, well, we can cut that.
It is unfortunate. It is it's a totally misguided budget, and you're right. This budget, doesn't do anything at all for working class Pennsylvanians, doesn't do anything to promote jobs in the state, doesn't do anything for transportation in the state, but yet they decided that they would cut education once again, both basic education, K-12 funding, and higher education.
You know, he said that one of the things he wanted to do, one of his major innovations, and again, it's not an innovation, it's the same failed policy that's been going on in this country for the last 30 years, but he says he wants to propose the use of block grants. And again, you know, the more I look at these block grants, no matter what the issue is, if it's welfare funding, if it's Medicaid funding, it always seems to never do what it's supposed to do.
No, absolutely not. It's a shell game. It's a shell game. Bottom line, as you say, well, I'm putting more money into the program, but basically what they've done is they've eliminated several programs, combined several line items together, makes the one number look a little bit bigger, but in the long run, what they're doing is they're cutting money, and they're taking money out of basic education. We're about $94 million short this year.
And what's that going to – well, first I should say what's that going to mean to me as a parent, second as a taxpayer, and third, what's it mean to small communities, small school districts who they can't afford to raise taxes on the local residents anymore?
Now, what it means to you as a taxpayer is your local property taxes are probably going to go up again. Governor Corbett's more concerned about his promise not to increase state taxes. But at the same time, he is forcing local districts, school districts, municipalities to increase taxes all across the state of Pennsylvania. What it means to your child in school is fewer programs, fewer teachers, less opportunities. There's no doubt this is the program that hurts our families, hurts our schools, hurts our kids.
You know, I looked at his speech today, and again, there was a bunch of things in there that just grabbed my attention. One of the things that he said is that, you know, corporations are going to come to Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania embraces free markets, and he said that businesses create jobs where they feel welcome. And my mind is just spinning because as a small business owner and someone who knows other small business owners, I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think an educated workforce has an awful lot to do with it. An infrastructure system that's been invested in. I think those are the more important things than some bizarre idea of, well, we somehow, free markets, we kind of believe it.
You're 100% right. The studies I've read that one of the top one or two issues that a business looks at when it decides to move into a state or not, the quality of the education and the quality of the school districts, and Governor Corbett is absolutely doing the wrong thing. He's hurting our schools. He's hurting our kids. And nothing in this budget addresses how do we deal with the school districts that are on the verge of complete failure, Chester Upland, York City, and I could probably name 20 other districts in the state of Pennsylvania that because of last year's cuts, we were really hoping the governor would step up to the plate and do what was right this year, fund our schools, and put back the money for the neediest students, for our minority students in those schools, for the students that have English as a second language, and provide the resources necessary for every child to be successful. And he didn't do that.
No, he didn't. But he did use some rhetoric, because he did say that every child can learn, Mike. And he says we need to instill that faith in every school in the state. Every school in Pennsylvania should be our best. And that's nice to say, but how do you do that when you can't pay your teachers, you can't keep the light bills on, you can't pay the heating bill?
You know what? Rhetoric is really nice in the political world. In the real world, we need resources in order to educate the children that sit in front of our teachers and our support professionals in the classrooms.
What bothers me is, you know, I looked at this story I talked about last night, that the Philadelphia schools are looking at closing on the weekends. In fact, they're going to. They're going to be closing on the weekends, and they're going to be closing at 8 o'clock every night. And canceling weekend programs, canceling other programs that they had as part of the community. And for me, you know, I'm looking at this, I'm going from the right-wing agenda, this idea that we need to destroy public education and make it private. This is a step for them in the right direction because they're taking the schools pretty much out of the community.
Right. And the schools should be the center of every community. I mean, we should be using our schools more. We should be rallying around them. We should be using them for social events in the community. Schools are a big investment in the communities, and for the governor to cut their funding to the point where they can't be used by the community anymore, it's just an absolutely horrendous budget.
And I want to go back to block grants for a second, because one of the things that's frustrating to me, and you brought up Chester Upland, which a place where the teachers had actually worked for nothing for several weeks until some funding came in, and may have to again before the end of the year because they don't have enough money. Because in their district, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they have a for-profit charter school in that district that has to be paid first. So the school district has money, say just like the block grant money. They've got the money. The first person who gets it is this for-profit charter school. And then, oh, by the way, we're going to, whatever's left, you and the public school can have. And as I've been saying since this story broke, this is what we're going to be seeing in every, first in every poor school district, and then into the middle class as they continue to destroy public education.
You're absolutely right. Not only do the charter schools get paid first, but the charter schools were the only schools in this state that did not receive a piece of the cut of funding that hit every school district, every other school district in the state this year, because charter schools are paid on last year's reimbursement levels. So even though there was an $860 million cut to every, you know, across the board, the schools in the state, the charter schools' funding this year is based on last year's revenue, so they didn't receive a cut. They're still demanding last year's higher subsidy levels instead of this year's piece of the cut. So not only do they get theirs first, but they get a bigger slice than every other child in the state.
Jeez, oh, man. And I look at this block grant thing, and the reason I brought that up is because by doing this, do you think by having these block grants now, it's going to make that system that we just laid out in that one district more likely in other districts?
Absolutely. The fact that, you know, he combined all these line items together makes it look like he's increasing funding. And what he's really doing is cutting funding.
Is there anything?
Go ahead.
Is there anything good in this in your mind?
No, there's not a good thing in this budget at all. I mean, there's no jobs program. There's no transportation funding. In addition to the second round of cuts here for regular education, for our K-12 system. The higher ed system is cut 20 and 30%, depending on the type of college. Higher education libraries are cut. Student loan programs are cut. This is across the board cut. Human services are cut. Mental illness programs are cut. This is a budget that hits those that could least afford it the hardest.
Well, what do you say to the people who say, you know, we're just, you know, Mike, we're broke? You know, I've heard this argument a number of times, even from people who I think are fairly intelligent. We're broke. We can't afford it. We've got to cut back on these things, on these luxuries.
I'm a school teacher. I'm not an accountant. I'm not an economist. But you know, when my wife and I sit down and we prepare our budget, we look at, you know, how do we control our expenses, and that's reasonable. But we also look at what do we need to do to bring in revenue to support our family, you know, and to do those things that help our family grows. And I think that's what the governor ought to be doing. The governor should be looking at increased revenues. Marcellus Shale could bring in close to $500 million every year. If we would tax the Marcellus Shale, the extraction of our own natural resources, if we would tax those the same as all the other states tax them, it could bring in $500 million more. 76% of the corporations in the state of Pennsylvania pay zero corporate net income tax. Governor says, corporate net income tax is too high. Actually, he's right on that. Okay, he's right on that because only the small mom and pop corporations pay it.
Yep.
If we could lower that corporate net income tax, make everybody pay their fair share, close the Delaware loophole, and the corporate net income tax would be lower for everybody, and then we could have another $400 million to support our public school system and human needs that we need here in the state of Pennsylvania. Close the loophole that says cigars and smokeless tobacco aren't taxed. $43 million. There's plenty of revenue out there. The governor just has to decide that he's going to.
Yeah, well, you know what it is he's all bent on the pledge. Got to keep the pledge. Mike, great talking with you. I appreciate it. I appreciate the information. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you again real soon. Mike Crossey, president of the Pennsylvania State Education Association. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Reason and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
What a sight to watch Newt Gingrich campaign for president. If ego was gas, he'd be the Hindenburg blimp. Most politicians try to puff themselves up a bit, but Gingrich is wildly bloviating about his worthiness and levitating his character to incredulous heights. For example, he insists that he's not merely a right-wing political writer, strategist, and operative. No, no. Newt says he is a transformative thinker, even anointing himself as the, quote, leader, possibly, of the civilizing forces. In fairness, he has been quite transformative recently, brazenly transforming himself from a three-decade Washington insider and corporate hired gun into a born-again champion of outsiders who hate moneyed elites. That's some trick, since he's a moneyed elite, albeit a particularly grubby one. Having been unceremoniously scooted out of the House speakership in 1998 because of both corruption and ineptness, he promptly turned to influence peddling, making himself rich by trading on his Washington connections to get favors for numerous corporate clients. His 2010 income topped $3 million. And he enjoys a net worth of some $6.5 million, including a luxurious home in one of suburban Washington's swellest zip codes. And last year, he ran up a $50,000 tab on jewelry purchases at Tiffany, the ultimate gilder of moneyed elites. But to really get Gingrich's goat, call him a lobbyist. I was never a lobbyist, he snaps. Yeah, and Bill Clinton never had sex with that woman. What Newt means is he never registered as a lobbyist, but there he's been for more than a decade, openly selling himself as a doorman for corporations wanting access to the capital city's power centers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Newt's not transformative, not an outsider, and damn sure not presidential. He's just another old fraud.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
If only that were true, unless you're talking about children and their funding for education. And I just can't get it out of my head, this block grant thing. I mean, haven't we learned this lesson before? I mean, haven't we seen this movie? I think I have. You look at the welfare funding. You look at the Medicaid funding. They put it out in block grants, and what ends up happening? They end up using it for everything under the sun. I'm telling you, these education block grants are a bad idea. This idea, oh, well, we'll just give it to the school districts and they'll know what to do with it. Yeah, set up all these for-profit charters. It's coming, man. I am telling you, mark my words, put it on the calendar, etch it in stone. It's coming. That Chester Upland deal, that is going to be duplicated and fast. Because it works. Look, if you can give me a gig where I'm guaranteed to get paid before everybody else, why do you think all this money is going, all this this vulture capitalist money is going into education? Because they know, man, they know they're going to get it before you and your kids do. We're the dumb ones in this. And I go back to my grandfather's generation. Would have never put up with this kind of, never. Granted, he only had an eighth grade education, but that you never threw anything by that guy. Because he had seen it all, he'd done it all, and he learned those lessons the hard way, as that generation remembered. Just an absolute, what a mess. Our quote of the day comes from Stuart Lansley. Wrote a piece over at The Guardian, Why Economic Inequality Leads to Collapse. He says, quote, an economic model that allows the richest members of society to accumulate a larger and larger share of the cake will eventually self-destruct. It is a lesson that has yet to be yet learned. And I would argue it has been learned. My grandfather's generation knew it. We've forgotten. And the more you hear people talk about history and rewrite it because they didn't know it to begin with, just make things up on the spot and nobody slaps them down. We've got people spewing what the founders were thinking. In fact, Glenn Beck wrote a book, What George Washington's Horse Was Thinking. I mean, how screwed up a society are we that on the top 10 bestseller list, there's a book that describes what the horse was thinking? And, oh, well, he's somebody to follow. I mean, it's amazing. And we've talked about yesterday, we talked about information from the Corporation for Enterprise Development. They came up with data showing that, you know, the top 1% of people in the country, not only do they pay less tax than most people, but their share of state taxes as well, well down there. In fact, in every state in the country, the top 1% in those states paid a smaller portion of their income in state taxes than the poorest 20%. And I went through and I looked at the data here in Pennsylvania, and I was absolutely shocked. The top 1% of people who live in Pennsylvania paid effectively paid 3.9% of their income in taxes. 3.9%. If you were in the bottom 20%, if you were the poor of the poor, you know, the people that this budget is kicking the snot out of, the ones that they keep saying, oh, those lazy welfare queens, those people at the bottom, that bottom 20%, paid an effective rate of 11.2% of their wages, their income, into state taxes. So I'm so tired of hearing these dim-witted puddle brain nitwits going on about, well, the rich people, they pay all the taxes. Yeah, stupid, they pay a large percent of large number of taxes. That's because they have the large number of money. If someone makes $4 billion and they pay $100 million in taxes, that's a large number, but it's not a big number of their percentage of their income. So stop and think for a bit. I mean, the righties, they're masters at pounding that. Well, you know, 57% of the 40, 80, 90, 100% of the people pay no taxes. But when you look at the actual number, you know, the facts, the things that, you know, kind of upset them. The reality is the Romneys of the world have walked away from this country. And we've allowed it through this blindness, this fog, this haze, whatever you want to call it. When you talk about the tax issue, there's like a Pavlovian response. Whenever anyone brings up the word taxes, people just start to drool. And you say, well, which taxes are we talking about? Nobody wants to know. They just want to drool. And I'm of the mindset, look, the reality being, Romney should pay a higher percentage of his income in taxes than the person that gave me a soda this morning at McDonald's. Does anyone disagree with that? Does anyone disagree that Mitt Romney, who really does really nothing, that he should pay higher taxes than someone who's working at the McDonald's? I mean, don't we think that way anymore? And then you move it into the small business world. Because, you know, Corbett's speech today, well, we want to be business friendly. And to him, evidently, this, if we show the world that we believe in free markets, whatever that means, that businesses will then come. We can have a dumb workforce, because we're cutting education. We can have kids that can't read, people who don't know which buttons and can't be trained. We can basically have the movie Idiocracy, a whole bunch of those citizens here. We can have crumbling infrastructure and horrible roads and bridges and the water, everything just shot because we're not investing in it. But companies will still come here because we believe in free markets. Does that make any sense to you at all? Because it makes no sense to me. But that's what the governor's pushing. He's peddling this idea that, you know, we can cut education. We can cut social programs. We can not worry about transportation again. But as long as we say we believe in free markets, and we cut all those regulations, and we, of course, give a whole bunch of money and tax breaks, the businesses will come. And I'm telling you, at some point, businesses are going to look at this going, well, why would we come? You have a dumb workforce. And you have a crumbling infrastructure. You know what businesses want? They want customers. You know what they want? They want demand. And I look at this new poll put out by the folks at the Small Business Majority, along with the American Sustainable Business Council and the Main Street Alliance. They have found that the majority of small business owners, well, what they want to do away with the Bush handouts. Let the tax rates go back to the way they were. And you know what? Help those people making less than $250,000 a year. Give them the tax breaks so that you put money into their pockets. I said in the beginning, when Bush did this back in 2001, I said if we were going to give away that $1.7 trillion in tax money, where you should have given it to anyone who made less than $50,000. If you made over $50,000, sorry, you can't have it. You want to spur the economy, you want to get the economy moving, you want to get the wheels churning, and you want to get everything all lubed up and ready to go, you put the money in the hands of people who are going to spend it. But we didn't do that. What we did is we gave all the money to people who, well, they save all their money, and they invest in foreign companies. Because that's what they did with the money. Understand what they did with it. So we basically financed. It's like the tax break we give to companies who move overseas. We actually help finance their move, and give them a going away party and present. Here you go. Thanks for leaving. I mean, it's nuts, isn't it? But it's what we did. And what I find really amazing, you look at some of the states that had the most egregious tax codes, where the top 1% got pretty much scot-free. States like Washington and Florida and South Dakota and Nevada and Wyoming. The top 1% in Washington state paid 2.6%. The bottom 20%, 17.3%. And you go, wait a minute. Explain to me how that's fair. Oh, it's not. Because those poor people at the bottom, they can't afford lobbyists. They don't have the big ExxonMobil money. They don't have the GE money because they don't pay taxes anyway. But amazingly, our governor made reference to both of them. Of the three companies he referenced, two of them, GE, ExxonMobil, two of the nation's biggest tax dodgers. And you wonder why we're in the mess we're in. Think of all the money we've given away and where we've given it to. We've given it to the Romneys of the world. We've given it to the GEs and the Exxon. Oh, but Rick, they're job creators. GE shipped more jobs out of the country than I think any other company in pure numbers. ExxonMobil doesn't really give a rat's behind about this country. All they care about is having access to the market to be able to gouge our eyes out with oil prices. So where we go? I say we go back to the good old days. And this is where the ballot box has to be so important. This is where we have to make this decision in November. Are we going to continue to put Corbettites and Walkers and Romneys in office? Are we going to continue pushing the T-twits in who keep talking about, oh, we need to be business friendly? Are we going to keep buying the corporate line, the billion-dollar attack that's coming on both sides in negative advertising? Are we going to buy that nonsense? Or are we going to stand up and say, you know, I've had enough already? We need people who have solid middle-class, working-class values. For me, I wish a politician would say, you know, I'm about a paycheck away from being broke, but we need to get back to work, and we need people who are going to be honest and who are going to fight for people like me, not millionaires and billionaires. We got enough of them in Congress. We don't need much more. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, I'm working all the time. It seems to me I could live my life a lot better than I think I am. I guess that's why they call me. They call me the working man.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Somewhere around the planet, there's going to be a tree falling, and that will not be replaced. We lose a football field's worth of forest every 4 seconds.
You're listening to satellite researcher Alan Bellward of the European Commission's Joint Research Center. He's talking about deforestation, where forests are cleared for land to grow crops or raise cattle. In 2011, Dr. Bellward was part of the most comprehensive forest survey ever, which involved over 190 countries. He told EarthSky that since 1990, the world has lost 180 million acres of forest.
Forests are an absolutely fundamental part of the climate system. I mean, deforestation accounts for about 12% of all anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide.
Anthropogenic changes are those caused by humans, and one key tool to seeing all changes to Earth's forests, said Bellward, is the U.S. Landsat program of satellites, which since 1972 have continuously and precisely monitored the world's forest cover. What's more, Landsat provides the data freely and openly to anyone in the world.
The Landsat provides us with a really quite detailed picture of the forest canopy. It's not just a photograph, it's actually measuring light outside the range of sensitivity of the human eye. And we're able to pick up subtle changes in the forest canopy.
EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, you know, like it always is. Yep, like it always is. I mean, you look at... You know, the president brought up the whole thing about the Stock Act. Want to make sure that congressmen aren't using inside information. And it was all a whole bunch of more, oh, let's get it done. And then, oh, that kind of bogged down. And, you know, me personally, I thought they were going to pass something fairly weak. Hey, we got something done. See, we can work in bipartisan fashion. But it's deeply entrenched. This cronyism. And I look at this new Washington Post investigation, where they point out that this Senator Richard Shelby, because remember, understand, there's an earmark ban. No more earmarks. Can't have earmarks. I guess earmarks are bad. I don't agree with that position, but for right now's premise, the Republicans have said they're bad. So you've got Richard Shelby, this senator from Alabama, who evidently got $100 million in federal earmarks to renovate this downtown area of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Turns out, he's got a commercial building right there. He reaped huge benefits from it. Why? Because if you increase the value of the neighborhood, of course, his office building is going to, of course, increase in value. Now, is that something that he did to satisfy himself? Did he go into this going, well, I got that building down there, and I think I'm going to make it worth more by increasing the value of the neighborhood? Or is it just a byproduct? Now, at some point, should we not be going, hey, you know, if that's the case, you've got to disclose that in advance or we're going to take it from you. I mean, at some point, there's got to be some openness. There's got to be some transparency, right? I think so anyway. Republican from Georgia, Jack Kingston. Representative got $6.3 million, according to the Washington Post, in taxpayer dollars to fix up a beach next to his island vacation home. So, you know, hey, got to fix up the beach, got to make everything look nice for when the kids go out and play. Really? And then again, I asked the question, did he do it to make his value better and his neighborhood better? Or was it the right thing to do? Now, I would argue in both scenarios, it's what they saw and said, you know what? We need to fix this because that is not right, and I want it to be nicer for me. It's kind of like I interviewed a representative not too long ago who was upset about something that affected him personally, and he was pretty adamant. Look, this is, you know, this happened to me, and I'm going to fix it. And, you know, hey, great. As long as it benefits all of us, I'm okay with it. But these instances, you got a question. Now, on the earmark front, I'm not as opposed to earmarks as everyone else seems to be. Because I understand those earmarks, that's how some things get built. And that's how we get jobs created. Because government does, like it or not, create jobs. Now, what is it we're spending it on? That's a whole other discussion. You know, to build a hospital, I'm okay with having an earmark to help build a hospital. I'm okay with earmarks to help build schools or, you know, whatever. I'm not so thrilled with teapot museums because I really don't like teapots. But, you know, some people do. And maybe that's an argument to be had, but it should be something that's discussed at least. And then I come to the idea, well, you know, what if we voted on every single expenditure? And this is where the righties want us to go. Every single expenditure has to be voted on. Do you have any idea how many votes would be cast in an appropriations bill? I mean, any idea? They would be voting for 1,000 years on 1 year's appropriation bill, especially if there was any bones of contention and they actually had to debate each and every spending issue. So on the grand scheme, I get the need for earmarks. But from a kitchen table economic position, I understand having the discussion about every expenditure, like I have with my wife. Every time we buy something big, we have a quick conversation about, should we do that? Is it worth it? Yes, no, maybe, sometimes. Sorry, when you're talking about massive numbers of expenditures, I don't know. Anyway, some good news for John Boehner. John has been fully endorsed by the indoor tanning industry, evidently. Their political action committee. Did you know the indoor tanning industry has a political action committee? I guess I got to get a political action committee. I guess we should all have one. Since corporations are people, we should just become corporations. We could have our own PACs. But they've contributed $5,000 to Boehner's campaign and another $5,000 to the RCC for his speaker committee. So $10,000 from the tanning salon industry. They're all upset about, of course, the Affordable Care Act because someone said, you know, maybe we should tax that. So not happy, which is kind of interesting that they would give it to the tan man. And I wonder, does he actually go to the tanning salon? Because every time I see him, when you used to see him when he was really orange, it looked like that spray on stuff. So my question was, does he actually use one, or are they just on his side? Anyway, I don't know. The end of this month, looks like we're heading for another hostage situation. So get your 24 clock out, because the ticking bomb is about to continue. Because we can't seem to get this payroll tax cut thing done, and I don't even know what they're doing on it. I know that Boehner wanted to attach the Keystone XL project to it, which again I saw some really great numbers. Someone was pushing out the idea that it was going to create 252,000 jobs. And I just said, wow, 252,000 jobs? Are you really? No, I mean, I guess I could just pull a number out of my backside, too, you know, and pop it out there, and there's 1 million jobs created. And I guess the only way you get to that is you build it, and then you tear it down. And then you build it again and tear it down and build it again. So maybe that's how they're getting to the numbers. I'm not sure. But even then, I'm not against that because it gets people back to work. It's the economy moving. And because if we're building something we don't need anyway, you know, why not? Because understand, we've got pipeline capacity right now that we're not using. And anything that comes through, going to be shipped overseas anyway. And the BPs and the Exxons, they're just gonna profit from it more. So you look at the profit numbers. BP had a huge profit year last year. They posted earnings of $23.9 billion on this morning. Now that last year had a little trouble. You know, they suffered that that loss of $4.9 billion in April of 2010. Had that little explosion problem. Had that little trouble. But, you know, profits right back up. They were very happy. And, you know, I'm wondering what's going to happen with all of this because the more I learn about it, the more troublesome this whole thing becomes with the explosion and how that's all going. But the good news, Romney's benefiting from this because I think they want Obama out because Obama had the audacity to say, you're going to have to put up about $20 billion. You remember that? Obama said, hey, you're going to have to put some money up. And you actually had a congressman saying that, giving testimony, president shaking him down. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Was it Joe Barton? Was that the guy's name? From Texas? I'm pretty sure his name was Barton. The guy who was all in tears. How dare the president shake people down? And I'm going, but hold on. They did cause a fairly big spill that did cost people their livelihoods for quite some time. I guess that doesn't matter, does it? Well, not according to Righty World. But yeah, I mean, he was basically so apologetic that how dare the president ask for any money to make sure that things aren't taken care of. I think I have the clip here. It's pretty funny.
I'm speaking now totally for myself. I'm not speaking for the Republican Party. I'm not speaking for anybody in the House of Representatives but myself. But I'm ashamed of what happened in the White House yesterday. I think it is a tragedy of the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterize as a shakedown. In this case, a $20 billion shakedown.
Yeah, I apologize. I'm sorry. Well, he eventually went back on that. But Romney's going to be pretty happy because he's gotten about $1.2 million from the oil industry that they've pumped into his Restore Our Future super PAC. So good news for him. But yeah, that Barton thing just blew my mind. The Koch brothers were part of that. One of the Koch brothers, not the two, not Charles and David, but Bill. Evidently, Bill's a billionaire of his own. He donated $250,000. His company, $750,000. So there you go. I mean, now we know where the interests lie. So good news. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Kathy Jellison, president of SEIU Local 668, about the budget and what it's going to mean for her members, for the people that they take care of, and for the state. Quick break, right back after this.
I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Flight attendants from more than 20 airlines protested at Los Angeles International Airport Monday against what the union says is the latest attack on collective bargaining rights in the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill before Congress. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says Republican House leaders and Democrat Senate leaders are proposing drastic changes to the labor law that governs the airlines. The union says, quote, by requiring the support of at least 50% of an employee group before a union representation election could be held, where currently there is no statutory requirement, Congress is trying to undermine a worker's choice to have union representation, end quote. The Flight Attendants Union says the controversial labor provision is nothing less than an attack by the 1% against the 99%. The union likened it to attacks on collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin and Ohio. On April 25th, there will be a global teach-in, a town hall-style meetup on the Internet to lay the groundwork for creating a global network to advance the agenda of the world's 99%. Jonathan Feldman is an associate professor at Sweden's Stockholm University and the chief convener of the global teach-in.
We have to build up alternative institutions and deal with financing, job creation, and some kind of major investment in public works, infrastructure, and these alternative technologies. And so cutting the military budget, moving our money out of the established banks into alternative financial institutions, as well as selective reinvestment, by which I mean unions and other activist groups and consumers can move their money into networks that would create jobs. All these things will be discussed in the context of this global teach-in.
Walmart is once again being hit with discrimination charges. Nearly 500 female employees of the retail giant filed charges last week with the Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission. The filing comes after the Supreme Court declined last year the right of current and former employees to file a class action lawsuit due to the women working in many places under numerous bosses. The plaintiffs allege that women are paid less and promoted less often than men. By filing with the EEOC, the women start the process of filing individual lawsuits against the company. If enough complaints are filed, it could trigger an investigation by the commission. The Supreme Court simply said the plaintiffs couldn't file as a class action and didn't come down one way or another on discrimination. It is possible that multiple class action lawsuits can be filed by various groups of women. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I've worked for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, hate the rules, the bosses knew would leave. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem? How did folk become all mine? The governor says they're tightening their belt. The only one to tighten is mine.
Well, not only are they tightening the belt, they're tightening the noose around my neck. I mean, strangling me. I mean, you look at this budget, 2 years in a row, we're talking major, massive cuts, major pain. And, you know, I look at the vote they had the other day, back at the end of January, House Resolution 535, 193-0. They declared this year, in the state of Pennsylvania, this is the year of the Bible, 193-0. And as I've said before, this budget, this is his morality. This is his value. These are his values. This is the year of the Bible, and this is what he comes out with. He says, the budget I bring you is built to transform the public welfare system, not to eliminate it, but to right size it. Yet he's eliminating the general assistance budget. Mind-blowing. That's why I've asked Kathy Jellison, president of SEIU Local 668, to come talk to us a bit. Kathy, thanks for taking time for me.
You're very welcome.
It is the year of the Bible, so the legislature has told me. Do you think this budget has anything to do with the biblical teachings that they have said is now this year?
Well, the Bible never says that you cut off the poorest and the neediest people, and that's exactly what he did today. he announced that he intends to eliminate the general assistance program, which, I mean, is morally and economically wrong. It's certainly the wrong idea and the wrong time, and it goes after the wrong people.
You know, I looked at this, and you know, the one word, one phrase keeps popping into my head over and over again, and it's, I get it from my T-Twizzler friends, redistribution of wealth. We're basically stealing from poor people, taking food out of kids' mouths, taking opportunity away so that we can give tax breaks to corporations.
Absolutely. I mean, the governor had an opportunity here to not only close the $500 million shortfall, but to have money in the general fund to take care of the neediest people in Pennsylvania, and he turned his back on us. So the war on the poor continues.
So now, you know, looking at your members who, you know, I'm you know, listening to some of the righties today going on that the whole reason our budget problems are where they are is because those workers, they want health care and they want wages and they want to feed their families. So the argument is you're the problem.
Yeah, we've heard that we're the problem, but I got to tell you, we are certainly not the problem. I think at this time and stage, I think unions are the solution to the problem. I think the only way we can lift people up is by helping them join unions, because the governor is certainly pushing the poor people down.
Absolutely. You know, I look at this, again, you know, I go back to that redistribution of wealth thing, where we're basically taking from the bottom and giving to the top, and they're okay with that. And this, his speech today, continued to hammer that point, that we need to be more business friendly. We need to tell business that we're into free markets. But we're going to underfund education. We're going to not do anything on our transportation. And for the folks who are at the bottom, well, you're on your own.
Absolutely. I mean, the general assistance program is actually only for the most vulnerable citizens in Pennsylvania. I mean, these are people that are disabled or sick that can't work. I mean, they cannot work. Domestic violence survivors, adults caring for another person who's sick or disabled, children living with an unrelated adult. I mean, these are the people that are going to suffer under this cut to general assistance.
You know, I look at this and the phrase penny wise, pound foolish pops into my head. You know, I think of a lot of the things that your members do, taking care of people in their homes, taking care of the least among us. What's it going to cost us if we can no longer have those programs? What's it going to cost us in other types of care and in having the burden shifted somewhere else?
Well, if you look at this program, I mean, general assistance pays maybe an average of $200 a month in most counties. You know, some are a little less and some are a little more, but that's less than 25% of the federal poverty line. It hasn't been increased since 1990. So, indeed, it is penny wise and pound foolish, because people will have to turn somewhere else now because they'll have nothing coming in.
Yeah, a little earlier, I spoke with Mike Crossy, president of the PSEA, and one of the things I brought up with him is, and I think this is really the destruction of public education, this idea of moving a good portion of the money into these block grants. In fact, it's something Corbett said was a major innovation that he's proposed. It's really nothing but the same things we've been doing in this country to destroy programs for years. But now where he's talking about moving money into these block grants for basic education and also for our welfare budget, and to me, that's just a way of destroying both of them.
I agree. And when you move money through a block grant, they give X number of dollars to a county, which is never enough, and then the county ends up turning on each other, fighting over how those dollars are going to be spent. So rather than fully funding public services, they have public services at each other's throats trying to help the people that need it.
And again, you know, it comes back to the year of the Bible. Explain to me how that's a good thing.
I mean, it's amazing. For some people, you know, the general assistance is like a loan program. They go on that waiting for Social Security when they apply for disability, and then when they're approved, they don't get their payments anymore. And it's certainly not being misused. I mean, since the recession started in December of 2007, the economy's lost over 100,000 jobs. But the increase in general assistance was only about 10,000 folks. So that's less than one-half of 1% of Pennsylvanians on general assistance.
As you were watching the speech, did you get the feeling, as I did, that he was basically pandering to the extreme right? He said, so what do we do? What traditions do we preserve? We can't maintain what we've been doing for 40, 50, or even 60 years when it hasn't improved the lives of the poor. When he's talking about welfare and he's talking about programs, that he's, you know, talking about block granting. And to me, I took that as, you know, that's that welfare queen statement. That's that getting people to think about, well, you know, there are people who've been doing this for 40, 50 years, and it isn't worked for them, so we should just cut them off at the knees.
Right, and that's simply not true. I mean, there have been mandates come through the welfare program where you can only stay on the SNAP program, for example, for 5 years. I mean, he's going about it in the wrong way. Rather than, they talk about waste and fraud, rather than having more caseworkers so that they can investigate more waste and fraud, they have caseworkers that they keep laying off, cutting back. You know, they retire, they don't replace them, and so they can barely get people benefits that need them, let alone investigate waste and fraud. It just can't be done with what he's proposing.
You know, I looked at, the speech, and he didn't say anything about privatization that jumped out at me. But I know part of what's going on behind the scenes. This governor has proposed a privatization commission, not looking into whether it's possible, but actually looking at what to sell off. And I look at our county nursing homes. I look at prison health care services. I look at those things, bus services, all these things up on the auction block. And I'm saying that eventually this stuff's going to turn around and bite us in the behind, as privatization always does.
I agree. And we haven't had the final report from the privatization committee yet that he has set up. But, you know, we're, of course, hearing rumors that he's going to close the youth development centers and the youth forestry camps, which take care of the juvenile youth in Pennsylvania. And to put them in a profit-making situation is never a good idea, ever.
Yeah, and you know, you go back and you look what this guy has done, and you know, and I bring this thing up about the Bible because I think it's important that, you know, they keep telling us, you know, we're a Christian nation and we believe in all this stuff. Yet the governor, right when he comes into office, 41,000 kicked off of adult basic, recently just kicked off another 88,000 kids off of the Medicaid program. I just go back to I don't see it, not getting it.
I mean, if he would take some simple steps and, you know, put a fair tax on the Marcellus Shell, close the Delaware loophole, and quit giving tax credits to big business, we would make up that $500 million shortfall in an instant, and in addition have enough money to put into the general fund to help the citizens in Pennsylvania that need it.
Yeah, but
you
Kathy,
know, rather than pander to the corporations.
But Kathy, then they wouldn't know that we're business friendly, and they wouldn't come because, understand, as the governor said today, they come here because Pennsylvania embraces free markets.
They come here because there's a lot of money to be made here, and they can go in and, you know, destroy our environment without any kind of censoring to them. That's why they come here.
Oh, you're so cynical.
Imagine that.
Yeah, but, I mean, the sad reality is what it is. And, I mean, when you're talking about the natural gas processing plant that they're talking about, the only reason they're going to come to Pennsylvania is not because of some idea that we're business-friendly or believe in free markets. How much money are we going to give them? How much infrastructure are we going to give away? How much, how much tax abatement and services? And how far are we going to pull Ohio and West Virginia down with us?
That's correct.
You know, there's something really wrong when we're making the conditions in West Virginia worse. How bad is it when Pennsylvania is pulling West Virginia down?
Yeah, how bad does it have to be?
And I guess, you know, my last question I have is, you know, what do we do to stop this? Is there any way to stop this, any way to turn this around? Is there any mobilization going on to push back? Because this is horrible.
Yeah, I mean, we've been working through the AFL-CIO. You know, we have the CLEAR Coalition that's been fighting back. We're gathering advocates all the time. As a matter of fact, there were over 200 people there today that were unemployed teachers, some of the Occupy folks, folks that are just saying we've had enough, and I think that has to continue. The only way I could describe what happened today was like the groundhog sticking his head out of its hole and delivering bad news and then going back in for another year. That's exactly what it felt like today.
Well, I've been calling him Punxsutawney Tom, so that fits right into it. Kathy Jellison, I appreciate the time. Keep up the fight. Thanks so much for coming and joining us.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
What a sight to watch Newt Gingrich campaign for president. If ego was gas, he'd be the Hindenburg blimp. Most politicians try to puff themselves up a bit, but Gingrich is wildly bloviating about his worthiness and levitating his character to incredulous heights.
For example, he insists that he's not merely a right-wing political writer, strategist, and operative. No, no. Newt says he is a transformative thinker, even anointing himself as the, quote, leader, possibly, of the civilizing forces. In fairness, he has been quite transformative recently, brazenly transforming himself from a three-decade Washington insider and corporate hired gun into a born-again champion of outsiders who hate moneyed elites. That's some trick, since he's a moneyed elite, albeit a particularly grubby one. Having been unceremoniously scooted out of the House speakership in 1998 because of both corruption and ineptness, he promptly turned to influence peddling, making himself rich by trading on his Washington connections to get favors for numerous corporate clients. His 2010 income topped $3 million, and he enjoys a net worth of some $6.5 million, including a luxurious home in one of suburban Washington's swellest zip codes. And last year, he ran up a $50,000 tab on jewelry purchases at Tiffany, the ultimate gilder of moneyed elites. But to really get Gingrich's goat, call him a lobbyist. I was never a lobbyist, he snaps. Yeah, and Bill Clinton never had sex with that woman. What Newt means is he never registered as a lobbyist, but there he's been for more than a decade, openly selling himself as a doorman for corporations wanting access to the capital city's power centers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Newt's not transformative, not an outsider, and damn sure not presidential. He's just another old frog.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Look at this lawsuit in South Carolina. And you got to chuckle because the Southern Republican Leadership Conference evidently had one of their shindigs at this swanky hotel, the Charleston Place Hotel. And the hotel saying, look, you know, they skipped out on a $227,000 bill because it basically had nobody show up. They had poor organizing. They agreed, and they said, look, we're going to sell out the hotel, the whole hotel. You turn people away because we're taking the whole thing. Then they got nobody. In fact, you know, they were supposed to have Newt Gingrich come in and talk at a 6,000-seat arena, and about 25 people showed up. And Santorum came and gave a speech to about the same number of people. Even though 1,700 people had signed up for it. So I guess, you know, there is an enthusiasm gap there that the Republicans are going to be suffering from. But, you know, hey, $227,000 in, and this is a good way to spend that corporate money, I think. Make sure you just waste it. So I hope they get sued. I hope they lose. And, well, because if it were you and me, man, we'd have to pay our bills, right? I'm sure if Romney wins, he'll pardon him or something like that. Anyway, interesting story by a Wall Street trader who's saying there's no other industry in the world where you could get paid so much money for doing so little work. And, you know, I look at the Romneys of the world, and you go, really? I mean, here's a guy probably never really done an honest day's work in his life. And when they talk about work, they do it in a way where they don't understand. They don't know what it's like to come home at the end of the day with your back aching and your every muscle in your body hurting. They don't know what it, and see, that's why it's so easy for them to say, well, we need to push Social Security off to 69 or 70 or 85 or wherever they want to put it. Because they don't, you know, sitting behind a desk pushing papers around, pushing a button, making money, and paying less tax than a guy swinging a hammer, that's what they know. So, and it's amazing. It's always amazed me that somebody with calloused hands and bruised knuckles would vote for somebody who, you know, I've said it about Obama, and I'll be honest with you. I wish I had another choice. Softest hands I've ever felt. As a lot of these other politicians, they don't get it. So is it surprising that, you know, someone who makes 4
billion dollars in a year, pays less tax as a matter of percentage than you and I, doesn't understand what we're doing, doesn't understand what's going on in the country? No, not really. And I've always said, you know, the hardest jobs I've ever had, the most work I've ever done, has been for virtually nothing. And you look at that reality, it's true. You know, I worked on a garbage truck for minimum wage when I was in college. Hardest work I've ever done. Amazing, amazing stuff. I think, and again, you know, one of the things I said about Obama from the beginning is I had hoped, I did have hopes, high hopes for him, that he would be the guy who saved work in this country, who valued work, that the reward would be there again, that the guy who goes and is dedicated and hardworking, that he'd have a shot. That if you went and you punched the clock and you did an honest day's work, you'd get an honest day's wage, and you'd have some retirement at the end, and you have some security. But every time I turn around, all I keep seeing is, well, we need free markets, and it's those greedy, evil unions who are screwing everything up. Life would be perfect if we didn't have labor laws. Life would be wonderful for business if we didn't have to deal with those unions. I mean, that's what the right's screaming about today. That's what the T-Twit tank over here is talking about. It's those unions who have run up the cost of everything. So you people who work hard, you have to pay more. Instead of saying, hey, you know, you're not making squat for a living because you're not organized. They're saying, no, it's the other way around. You're not making anything because we're taking away from the... I mean, it's really just a very twisted logic. But when you control the mass media, when you control the message machine, when it doesn't matter if you make money, and this is what I've always been amused about. They talk about free markets because, you know, like Corbett said today, we embrace free markets. Yet they prop up Limbaugh for 10 years who didn't make a dime for 10 years. They prop him up. Why? To keep pushing that message out there. Because they understand long view. They understand learning by osmosis. Where you just keep the message out there. You just keep pounding it out there. Even if you're wrong and you know you're lying and you know it's BS, you just keep pounding away. Because eventually you're going to get the message. It's the big lie theory. The more you put it out there, the more they're eventually going to get to it. And this whole frame that we're broke. I mean, how long are we going to take that? We're not broke. If we were broke, we wouldn't be giving massive amounts of money to corporations to, oh, please come here and build here. We wouldn't be giving huge tax abatements. We wouldn't be giving all kinds of economic development money. We wouldn't be doing it. Because we're broke. But that's the frame they keep pushing, man. So today in the speech, Corbett says, we will not raise taxes. There is no talk about these limits. Every dollar taken in taxes, one less dollar in the hands of a job holder or job creator, he says. Every dollar spent by government is $1 less in the sector that creates real prosperity. Ooh! What it is it's a massive redistribution of wealth because you did raise taxes. It's a tax shift to local communities, to college students, to homeowners, to hospitals, to home care workers. It's a massive cost shift downward. Do you not see that? And he's talking in almost the same breath. We're going to cut the net corporate income tax rate. Going to get rid of the capital stock and franchise tax. He wants to get rid of the estate inheritance tax. But you folks down at the bottom, we're gonna gut out the general assistance fund. You're screwed. We're gonna give the welfare department public a block grant. I'm telling you, this guy. You know, somebody wrote him a good speech, but it's dangerous. It's absolutely dangerous. And then we talked about transportation. It just kind of blew my mind. It is also critical that we address our transportation issues. Didn't he say that last year? Isn't this part of what last year was? We need to have something. Nothing got done. He says, this is not a budget item. No kidding. You didn't do it. He says it's too large for that. Transportation must be confronted on its own distinct and separate topic. This problem has grown the past several decades, and it's not going to be solved overnight. So basically, the message there is, well, we're going to ignore it for just another year, maybe two, and hopefully nobody notices. And hopefully no bridges collapse, and hopefully nobody dies. And since it is the year of the Bible, maybe we'll get more people praying as they drive over the bridges. I don't know. This whole idea of we have this mixed economy that he talked about, that you know there's free enterprise along with government encouragement. Does that mean my tax dollars? Because that's what it sounds like to me. Then he goes into the realities. In this nation, we've got the federal government, who I think has abdicated its responsibility to enforce the Commerce Clause. We are competing with every state in the union. He's right on that, for every job. And the sad reality is it's come down to who's willing to give up their education, who's willing to give up their social services, who's willing to give up their infrastructure to enrich these corporations. And I agree with him. You know, it's a race, it's a brawl, it's a fight, whatever you want to call it, but it's wrong and it's dumb. This is what not having a national manufacturing plan is. This is what not having a national vision has done. And he's okay with that, I guess. But he finishes the speech up, and you know, he got to pander to Ronald Reagan. So he takes a quote from Reagan. We must learn from the mistakes of the past. Government doesn't tax money to get its needs. It taxes to get money it wants. Big government has a way of spending all the money it can get its hands on, and then some. Not only does this excessive taxation put a ball and chain around our economy, it simply does not solve our spending problems. So basically, we're just going to continue to dwindle it down, and you just die off, hopefully. I guess that's the idea. Now, I find it ironic coming from Ronald Reagan, because this is a Reagan quote, a guy who was a huge borrow and spender. And I always found it amazing that he would say this, and he did. He was talking to the Realtors Association, I think it was back in 82. I always found it amazing that he would say things like this, knowing full well that he created the Social Security Trust Fund as his own little slush fund, so he wouldn't have to borrow money that people could see. And yet he still ran up massive budget deficits and raised taxes 11 times. But you can't get the righties to agree to what the facts were. He raised taxes 11 times. Yeah, he cut them twice. But at the end of the day, raise up. On who? Oh, yeah, you and me. You know that unemployment benefit that people are getting now? He taxed that. I mean, to me, that's a real slap in the face. But the righties, they don't, hey, those are just those working people. Don't care about them. And I'm hoping at some point we have folks this November who go to the polls and say, you know what? I'm not going to put up with it anymore. We've got to make the choice. And the choice is now. Do you have the right-wing vision of this country, which is you're on your own, and that the Romneys of the world and the Koch brothers and the billionaire class should be able to take everything they can get their hands on and keep it for themselves, that they can hoard everything that they can get their hands on? Or do you believe that we are a nation, one nation, truly under God, especially if this is a biblical year, if this is the year of the Bible? Are we truly one nation? Because we had to have that resolution passed. Are we truly that nation? Because you cannot have it both ways. You cannot continue to say we're going to give all of the riches and all of the wealth to the very top of the economic scale, and you people down at the bottom, well, you're just going to have to fight each other for the crumbs that might be left in the event that their pockets ever fill up. Oh, but by the way, we're still one nation. You can't do it. You know, it's like, oh, we're one family, but half the family lives down the road and we don't talk to them. And we won't let them any. We got guard dogs to keep them away. It's kind of nuts. But that's what they're peddling, man. And that's the message that's being pounded time and time again. All those people are lazy and shiftless. It is absolute. To me, this budget's just a crime. But it's not surprising. Not surprising at all. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other theft. And get ready, working families. Your kids are in big trouble. Back after this.
I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. And I announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Somewhere around the planet there's going to be a tree falling, and that will not be replaced. We lose a football field's worth of forest every 4 seconds.
You're listening to satellite researcher Alan Bellward of the European Commission's Joint Research Center. He's talking about deforestation, where forests are cleared for land to grow crops or raise cattle. In 2011, Dr. Bellward was part of the most comprehensive forest survey ever, which involved over 190 countries. He told Earth Sky that since 1990, the world has lost 180 million acres of forest.
Forests are an absolutely fundamental part of the climate system. I mean, deforestation accounts for about 12% of all anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide.
Anthropogenic changes are those caused by humans, and one key tool to seeing all changes to Earth's forests, said Bellward, is the U.S. Landsat program of satellites, which since 1972 have continuously and precisely monitored the world's forest cover. What's more, Landsat provides the data freely and openly to anyone in the world.
The Landsat provides us with a really quite detailed picture of the forest canopy. It's not just a photograph, it's actually measuring light outside the range of sensitivity of the human eye. And we're able to pick up subtle changes in the forest canopy.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
And from what you said, I know you've gotten over me. It'll never be the way it is.
Oh, yeah, well, look away. 1989, if I remember. Wow, it's been that long. It's been that long ago. Well, I guess that's where our governor wants to take our education funding back to. Back to the good old days. Back to the almost 90s. The 1890s, if you will. But, again, you know, I look at this budget, and you want to talk about redistribution of wealth. You want to talk about theft from the working class. I don't know where else, what other words to use. The numbers are just staggering. A total cut from the higher education budget of over $265 million. Understand, that is money that's coming out of working people's pockets to pay college tuitions. That, to me, is a crime, which is why I've asked Steve Hicks, president of APSCUF, to come talk to us about what's going on. The Association of Professional State College University Faculties, correct?
Yes. You almost got it. The acronym gives everybody trouble. It's great that you're playing the 1989 song, because that's where the funding the governor proposed would take us back to, is our 1989 level of dollars. So, 89 was a great year, right?
Well, yeah, it was a great year. I was much younger, but things have gone up since then. How much was college tuition back in 89?
About $2,000.
And how much is it today?
although over $6,000.
So we're funding it at $2,000 levels, expecting people to pay the additional $4,000 out of their pocket. I take it as a shift in a massive redistribution of wealth from workers and their families upward.
Well, that's exactly right. Every shift of state appropriation dollars is a shift to pulling money straight out of working families' pockets. And, you know, in this country, we used to think of public higher education as something that was free, but that's no longer the case. And, yeah, you know, the state system, our main audience is first-generation college students, and, you know, they're not in a position to be paying exorbitant tuition fees. And one of the outcomes of this, if it passes as it is fewer young people are going to go to four-year institutions and get college degrees in a time when everybody claims economically we need to be generating more degrees.
Yeah, and you look at the president's speech, you look at most of the discussion that's been going on the last 20 years at least, and high school not cutting it anymore. Well, your high school degree isn't what it used to be. People need to have bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, or vocational training even. And it looks like as a state and to a degree the federal level, we're kind of walking away from that, saying, well, if you want that better life, saddle yourself with massive debt. Which I think is a huge problem. I think I saw a statistic the other day. It says student loan debt that we're creating is over $1 trillion.
Yeah, student loan debt is now the second largest type of debt in the country. It's larger than credit card debt. Only mortgages are larger. So there's big business in there, and there's probably money to be made in student debt. I know some people in higher ed financing who think that this is the next big financial bubble, is the student loan.
Yeah, I mean, if that pops, it's all over, because you know, you've got all these kids graduating from college with degrees, going to these private private schools online, and the University of Phoenixes and the Waldrons and all these other places, and they're graduating and they're getting these degrees, and they're not finding jobs.
No, and you know, if you've looked into this, the percentage of people who start at the places you named, there's a very low percentage that finish. So, you invest a good number of dollars and a good number of federal dollars in grant and aids that you're able to get, and you come away without a degree, and nobody's satisfied then, and we've not made any progress.
So let me ask
you. The state system has a pretty good record of getting people through, so I think we're pretty proud of our graduation rate based on the kinds of students we bring in. So
I'm looking at this $265 million in overall higher ed cutting. But what's the number for the state system?
About $83 million. So about a third of what you're looking at.
But,
you know, it's not just that $83 million, but you're looking at, if you've got the spreadsheet, the next line item after the state system of higher education is the higher education assistance agency, which provides grants to students who can show that they need financial aid, and they cut them 5%. So not only are you cutting the system itself, but you're cutting the aid program. On the other hand, so you're hitting the student wallet two different ways.
What should we be doing? I mean, you know, there's this frame that the right has really pushed masterfully, this idea that somehow we're broke. Well, we just don't have any more money. We're broke. We can't afford education. We can't afford health care. We can't afford public services. We're just flat broke. That's it. Game over. Suck it up, or work at McDonald's. I guess that's the argument. What should we have been doing? What should we be doing differently?
Well, there are several things we should be doing differently. I've seen your guest list for today, and they're all friends of mine from the CLEAR organization, and we put out a report last week that showed that there are about $2 billion that the state, per year, the state's left on the table between the kinds of misuses we've had, as well as the kinds of taxes that we've let slide by. And, you know, I'm sure you recognize the irony of the fact that the last thing that was voted on before the governor got up and gave his budget speech in the Senate was the Marcellus Shale bill. So, you know, right there, we applied a tax to something that we know is going to happen at the lowest rate, essentially the lowest rate in the country. So we've left a lot of revenue on the table there. Everybody I've talked to who's been involved in the shale business, and practically every lobbyist in town has a piece of shale business, will tell you that all these shale people were willing to pay higher taxes. They just wanted the bill done so they knew what to pay.
Yep.
They were coming to Pennsylvania. They were putting down wells, and they were going, you know, draw the stuff out of the ground. They just wanted to know what they had to pay so they could put it in their cost structure. And we let them get away with the cheapest rates in the country when we're sitting here, and he gets up, you know, a few minutes later and says we don't have any money.
Yeah, I mean, it's mind-blowing. And it's mind-blowing, especially when you look at the fact that West Virginia has a much higher rate, and actually pretty rational. I thought that's where we should have gone.
Right.
And the governor last year said he wanted to be like Texas. That'd be a good way to go, how they deal with their natural gas. But there's something seriously wrong, as I've been saying, when we're pulling a state like West Virginia down, when we're leading the race to the bottom.
Right. Well, and, you know, we lead the race to the bottom in higher education, too. We've been 45th for years in per capita investment in public higher education in this country. So, you know, the governor, I don't think he really sits down and says, I want to race to number 50. But, you know, cutting 20% out of our budget and 30% out of the state-related, and, you know, was it 6 or 7% out of the community colleges is a you know, you can't move up from 45th doing that.
Right. So. Now, this isn't like basic education K through 12, where the burden's going to be shifted downward to the local school taxes. This is going to directly hit the students and their families, which could lead to, you know, a larger student loan bubble, in my opinion, or just less kids going to college and more unemployed people, more folks who have less opportunity, less earning potential, which I think comes back and bites us when you're looking at long-term taxation and revenue coming in.
Well, I mean, you hit a lot of great talking points there. I think one of the things to look at is how much education do we need here in the Commonwealth to compete with those around us. You know, we produce fewer degrees than all of our neighbors on a percentage basis. And, you know, the number's going down. If we want to compete in the long term, you know, we need an educated populace. And as you said, you can't keep taking it out of the working class's pocket. Right now, our average student out of a Posse institution is graduating with $23,000 of debt. And, you know, there's a quick transference, almost one-to-one between the cut in the state appropriation and how much tuition's going up. It probably means people will be borrowing more next year, or they won't be going because they've reached the end of their borrowing, you know, as much as they want to borrow. And most of our students are working a job part-time to make it through. And, you know, those extra hundreds that this will add to their tuition bill, you know, it's when you're making $8-$10 an hour, it takes a lot of those hours in a part-time job to make up that money.
That sure does. Let me ask you a last line of questioning. Now, I've got a friend who graduated from college back in the late 60s. She went through all the way through the University of Michigan, all the way through to get her law degree, walked out debt-free, worked a minimum wage job, lived in her own apartment, walked out without any debt whatsoever. Student loans just weren't an option then. Because the state, as I understand it and the way she explains it, the state and the federal government, they funded these things heavily.
Right.
Is the rise in tuition, does that have more to do with the fact that every time we turn around, the state is pulling money out of these institutions and the federal government's turning their back on higher education? Or is it the greedy teachers who just want more and more and their appetite for more never ends?
No, well, you know, I'm not going to go with the greedy teacher thing. Our numbers show that our pay scale is just barely kept up with inflation over the last decade. And to go back to your point, when we started as a system in 1982, 67% of the funding came from the state, 33% came from tuition. With these numbers, we're pushing more like 75% from tuition and 25% from the state. So right there it tells you the redistribution. I mean, you started off by saying that, you know, it's a cost shift from the state to the student, and that's why the expense has gone up as much as it has. And we've more and more put the burden on the student to pay for it. It's not a public good the way it used to be, you know, in the 60s and 70s. It's become, and Governor Corbett's big on saying so, you know, if you want a service, you have to pay for it. And we don't care, you know, how much it may benefit the state of Pennsylvania for you to have it. The state's not going to contribute. So
it's the idea.
It's an ugly trend line.
Yeah, it's the idea of the commons that they have destroyed, the things that is ours commonly, and the common good. Sad, sad day.
Well, you know, when the governor sits around at the country club with the people he hanged out with, they don't have any trouble writing college tuition checks. So I don't think he's quite as in tune with the people who are trying to go to the 14 state-owned institutions.
Excellent point. Steve Hicks, I appreciate the time. President of APSCUF, the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties. Thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
Great, Rick. Thanks for the show.
Yep. Let's take a quick break right back after this with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-745. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Wooling Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all hours ease conditions and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833 and considered is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Hughley Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Call me the American
dream. Call me your guarantee. Yeah, I listen to those numbers. And, you know, it's one of the things that I've been talking about for the longest time. Look, the state and the federal government has walked away from education. And you heard Steve Hicks say it. Look, at the end of the day, man, back when they started, 66% of the money came from the state or the federal government. And a third, 33%, came from tuition. Now that number completely the other way. Three quarters of the money coming in, 75% from tuition and just 22% from the state and federal government. That's basically just turning your back on it. And this is what's happened after 30 years of supply side voodoo Reaganomics. This whole let the market decide. Oh, we need to be business friendly and understand. We believe in free markets. This is what free markets are, friends. This is you can't afford it. Pay or die. Pretty simple. And I don't think it gets any easier than that. Let's go to the phones. I got Spike on line one. How are you doing tonight, Spike?
Doing pretty good. Nice to be able to talk to you during daytime for once.
I appreciate you taking the time for me. What's up?
Hey, well, first of all, as someone who's I'm a criminal justice major who's going to school on a Pell Grant, both federal and state, so essentially Governor Corbett doing a wonderful job cutting into the best way to re-educate me so I can work again. Because, you know, obviously since I was on unemployment, I'm also a freeloading socialist, according to Corbett and his cronies.
Well, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, because $99 a week, man, that's living large, especially when you have to pay about $55 a month just for a phone bill.
Do you have a tan from coming back from Hawaii and doing the whole thing?
Oh, yeah. You get great tans here in the Poconos, let me tell you. But, you know, it's absurd that, not to mention, too, not only cutting college funding, which there's a lot of that today, but there's further cutting of public education funding. And, you know, people don't look beyond the reach of their hand sometimes, these supporters of Corbett and these corporate prostitutes is what they are. They're turning tricks for the gas drillers and, you know, the for-profit charter schools and these individuals. What they forget to notice is when you keep cutting public school education funding, not only do you cut those dang public, you know, union teachers' jobs, you also cut into real estate value, because the more and more you have rundown, empty schools, the more, you know, education suffers, the worse the test scores are, the more in criminal justice, the socioeconomic effect of the, you're going to have an increase in crime, increase in blight, and in turn, a decrease in real estate value. So what's the odds if you pay $250,000 for a house and they keep making all these cuts, you're even going to break even on that house when it's time to sell?
Yeah, but here's the thing, Spike, for the people who matter, because the people who bought that house don't matter. You don't matter. I don't matter. The people who really matter, the billionaire class, the Romneys of the world, they see that situation differently. You laid out a pretty negative, a pretty dire situation. Let me turn that around and give you the investor class view. So the schools go to pot. I don't have to pay school taxes. I don't have to deal with that. I can build a nice, shiny new prison to put those kids in. I can fill those cells, and I can make big profit off of it. All of that property that people used to have that they're now underwater on, I can go in and buy it up really cheap because they're going to walk away from an underwater mortgage. I can get that property cheap. I can turn it into a Walmart or a big superplex or whatever, and I can make big coin off of it. So from the investor class view, that's the perfect scenario.
Yeah, or these absentee landlords that rent slum after slum in the hood, and, you know, they don't care if the places are dilapidated and falling apart and crime infested. Hey, they're getting their checks, or
right there.
Really their cash often, so it doesn't matter to them one bit. You know, with George Carlin referred to these people as our owners, you know, they own the society from the media to, you know, the structure of government, you know, they own us, and they're just doing whatever works for their best needs. That's absolutely spot on. And the other thing with charter schools, you know, I'm in the Pocono Mountain School District here, and they're roughly about $10 million in debt for the upcoming school year, and about $4.5 million of that million goes to, right around the corner from me, the Pocono Mountain Charter School, which is a charter school under tons of investigation because it's attached to a church, a mega church, and there's all sorts of things that went on there, like essentially tax dollars used to pay for signs to promote the church.
Nice.
The church's name is on the floor of the gymnasium of the school, not the name of the charter school. You know, lots of questions about whether or not really is the tax dollars really going towards education there, or is it really going towards a mega church? I mean, I can tell you for a fact, you know, the pastor that runs this church, he lives in a big McMansion, he wears fancy expensive suits, drives a BMW, you know, because his house is right around the corner from me. I see this firsthand.
he's living large, and he's living large off of our tax dollars. You know, he had to step down because the government started to force, state investigation essentially forced him to step down as CEO of the charter school, but he's still the landlord of the building it's in. So essentially, he's still making money hand over fist off of our tax dollars. Meanwhile, you know, that's 50% of the Pocono Mountain School District's, or close to 50% of their debt, is the charter school, which really should have never happened in the first place. That was back when we had an exclusive Republican school board here who thought it was a great idea, and they didn't see a conflict of interest with church and state going on there. It's still a mostly Republican school board, which is a big part of its problem, but at least now there's a little bit of influence to, you know, look into this charter school some more. But in the meantime, just like Chester, Poca Mountain has to pay them no matter what. And you know, that, how fair is that to me that, you know, I'm getting the shaft on my end for my education to work in criminal justice, to work as a state constable, an educated state constable, which is sorely needed in the Commonwealth, and yet, you know, this guy running the charter school, he's a snake oil salesman, and he's cashing in on tax dollars, tax dollars.
Absolutely.
You know?
And you look, and as I've been saying, look, you're the Chester Upland School District. Now you've pointed out Pocono Mountain, is that what it is?
Yes, Pocono Mountain School District.
Again, you know, who gets paid first? The for-profit charter school. Who gets stuck with the bill? We, the taxpayers.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just insane. There's other words to describe it, but that are not radio-friendly. But it's just absolutely insane. And if people really put in more than 30 seconds of thought, they would see just how much of a shaft Corbett continually gives us. For that matter, before I got, with the whole criminal justice background, the FOPs were loving Corbett. They endorsed him like there's no tomorrow. What was the first thing with him, with Christie and Wisconsin, all these governors, these less government governors, first thing they did, cut the budgets for these police departments. Now all these law enforcement officers are losing their jobs. Fat chance they're going to find anything even close to the same sort of pension they could get in law enforcement.
Yep.
And they're going after those pensions as well. You know, that's the other thing I'd like to just note out there. If there's anyone, you know, cruiser listening to this broadcast, you know, you are government. When they say less government, that means less of you. You know, less pensions for you, less funds for you, less benefits, less hours for you.
Yep.
That's what they want to cut. They never want to cut the elected government officials' salaries or jobs. I have yet to ever see a governor, Republican, get in and say, yeah, you know what, I'll work for free. It never happened.
He did make reference today to legacy costs. So if there are any public workers out there, he was thinking about you in his speech. And you're so right, Spike. I appreciate the call, brother. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, man.
Call anytime. Appreciate it. And, you know, I look at this, and, yeah, absolutely. This is the screw job of the century. And before we take a break, might as well play a little bit of the George Carlin.
They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly easier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club.
No, that sure is true. We sure are not in the big club, but we've been getting it all right. But this budget, man, state workers, they didn't forget about you. The legacy cost. Legacy! How dare you want pensions? How dare you want health care? But you know, I go back to my friend, graduated from law school all the way through the University of Michigan, came out debt-free. Back when we used to believe education was something that was good for the country, it was part of the commons. It was part of what we decided as society that we wanted. We wanted an educated populace. We wanted people who were critical thinkers. This budget kind of makes me wonder. Quick break right back after this with Donna Cooper from the Center for American Progress. Stick around.
Middle class, and we ain't even planning on losing in this fight war. The working class is under attack. Get up, fight on. Stand up, fight on. Yes, we can't fight on.
listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Flight attendants from more than 20 airlines protested at Los Angeles International Airport Monday against what the union says is the latest attack on collective bargaining rights in the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill before Congress. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says Republican House leaders and Democrat Senate leaders are proposing drastic changes to the labor law that governs the airlines. The union says, quote, by requiring the support of at least 50% of an employee group before a union representation election could be held, where currently there is no statutory requirement, Congress is trying to undermine a worker's choice to have union representation, end quote. The Flight Attendants Union says the controversial labor provision is nothing less than an attack by the 1% against the 99%. The union likened it to attacks on collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin and Ohio. On April 25th, there will be a global teach-in, a town hall-style meetup on the Internet to lay the groundwork for creating a global network to advance the agenda of the world's 99%. Jonathan Feldman is an associate professor at Sweden's Stockholm University and the chief convener of the global teach-in.
We have to build up alternative institutions and deal with financing, job creation, and some kind of major investment in public works, infrastructure, and these alternative technologies. And so cutting the military budget, moving our money out of the established banks into alternative financial institutions, as well as selective reinvestment, by which I mean unions and other activist groups and consumers can move their money into networks that would create jobs. All these things will be discussed in the context of this global teach-in.
Walmart is once again being hit with discrimination charges. Nearly 500 female employees of the retail giant filed charges last week with the Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission. The filing comes after the Supreme Court declined last year the right of current and former employees to file a class action lawsuit due to the women working in many places under numerous bosses. The plaintiffs allege that women are paid less and promoted less often than men. By filing with the EEOC, the women start the process of filing individual lawsuits against the company. If enough complaints are filed, it could trigger an investigation by the commission. The Supreme Court simply said the plaintiffs couldn't file as a class action and didn't come down one way or another on discrimination. It is possible that multiple class action lawsuits can be filed by various groups of women. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
I tell you, I'm hoping the outrage, the anger of the people rises up to where we get Punxsutawney Tom to head back to the hills. It's just mind-blowing, this whole complete walking away from education, from the poor, especially when you're talking about Pennsylvania declaring that 2012 is the year of the Bible. I mean, it's just mind-blowing to me. And I've been telling you this has been coming for the last couple of weeks, ever since they decided to pass their non-binding resolution, making 2012 the year of the Bible. Just nuts. And on our transportation needs, what did he say? He basically said, well, you know, it took us decades to get to this point. We're not going to fix it overnight, so maybe next year. Maybe we'll talk about it sometime in the future. It's nuts. Anyway, I've got Donna Cooper on the line, senior fellow with the economic policy team over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. She was also in the Rendell administration for a number of years, so it'll be interesting to get her views on the budget proposal. Donna, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, great to be with you, Rick.
So it looks like we've really turned our back on higher education and basic education as well. These insane block grants, just nuts to me.
Well, and turn their back on the poor. I mean, they're eliminating the entire healthcare services for people who are severely, you know, disabled and out of work. So single adults who might have a serious condition and no access to healthcare, well, you know, somebody else is going to have to take care of them. So it's, you know, when you said Groundhog Day, I wish it was, because this budget seems worse than last year's.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you when you look at the education numbers, you know, I've talked about a friend of mine who graduated from Michigan, University of Michigan, back in the late 60s, all the way through till she got her law degree, working a minimum wage job. She lived on her own, had no student loan debt, had nothing coming out of college, because evidently back then we believed in higher education. We believed in education, period. And when I was talking to the guy who's the president of APSCuff here, he said that back in the 80s, the funding level was about 66% from the state and the federal government. Tuition made up about 33%. Today, that number's 75% of the money comes from students and tuition. Just how we
that's how our community college system in Pennsylvania is supposed to be, 30% from students, the other balance from state and local government. And even in our community colleges, because local governments haven't kept up their share, they're paying 40 and 50% of the tuition costs, even for that low-cost product, and many people are having a hard time doing that these days.
So the question then becomes, what kind of a society do we want to have? Do we want to have a society based on whether I can afford it, or if I'm willing to go hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt for the chance of having opportunity, or do we believe as a society that we should all have a shot?
Well, even more, Rick, I mean, it's really about what kind of society we all want to live in, and I'm better off when somebody graduates without a ton of debt, because that means they can be an active consumer. That means they can start a business. The whole saddling of students with debt is undermining our economic prosperity for all of us. It's just a bad, bad way to go if we have any hope of maintaining a middle class, large middle class in this country.
You know, I've talked to a number of folks here today about this budget, and a lot of my neighbors who are not fans of your previous boss are now missing the days of Ed Rendell when it comes to education.
Sure. And, you know, we had the first 2 years when Ed Rendell was in office, we had come into office with a $3.2 billion deficit. But, you know, we had a decision to make, and it's really the decision that I think is at the root of the conversation in America around the 99%, which is, are we going to protect people who have large sums of wealth from taxation, or are we going to collectively invest our fair share so that we can prepare for the next generation? And that means investing in schools. That means making college affordable. Obviously, it means rebuilding our roads and bridges in Pennsylvania, where they're among the worst in the country. These are the things that one generation does for another, but the social contract between generations has been broken by this ideological, fanatical protection of taxes on the wealthy.
Yeah, and this other fanatical idea that we need to somehow be more business friendly. You know, the governor actually said that companies are going to come to Pennsylvania because we embrace free markets, not because we have good education or good infrastructure or you know, smart workers. No, just because we believe in free markets and we're going to be friendly to them.
Well, I mean, come on, you know, that's kind of a red herring. The free market issue is sort of a fait accompli in America. This is a capitalist country. There is a free market. The problem is that they say that out of one side of their mouth, but this budget has tax benefits for certain players in the free market. If you're a research and development company, and by the way, if you're a big one, you get a big tax break. So that goes to large pharmaceutical companies, by and large. So, you know, Joe starting a business in his basement to research something is not likely to get that R&D tax credit. But, you know, Roman Haas, they will. So we have free market for some. And this budget protects those. And it also does nothing to address the extraordinary gaping holes in our tax code that lets 76% of every corporation in the state pay no taxes.
And I never understood it. Maybe you could explain, how'd that ever come about? Because it seems just plain dumb to me.
Well, here's how it came about. So it used to be everybody was doing business in their own state. You know, when you went to the hardware store, it was a neighborhood hardware store. Now it's a Walmart, right? And so we're a Home Depot. So as the country became national, had national companies and people were able to locate in another state and do business in Pennsylvania, they are able to, they have to obviously pay sales tax in Pennsylvania, and they have to pay taxes on the net income that they earn in Pennsylvania. But the key word there is net. And so when a company is located in Delaware, what they do is they say part of our cost to do business in Pennsylvania are our royalty and trademark costs that we pay on our products. And there's really not a great standard for how that's calculated. So let's say I have a sewing machine and it's a Singer sewing machine, and the royalty and trademark value of that, it's not just the cost of it, but the value is $80 for every sewing machine I sell. So that's now a cost that is deducted from my company of what I pay in Pennsylvania. I should be paying that in the home state where I am. I should pay it somewhere,
right,
the income, that $80. But if I locate in Delaware where there are no taxes, or I locate in the Bahama where there are no business taxes, then I don't pay that anywhere. And so basically people have been offshoring the value of their royalty and their trademark and their goodwill profits, and that profit is not being taxed anywhere. And at this point, 21 states have passed a law that says if you do business here, you have to apportion the profits here, including the profits that are associated from royalty and trademarks and goodwill. 21 states have passed that. So because what happens by not doing that is the guy who does business in Pennsylvania and Pennsylvania only, a real Pennsylvania company,
yep,
that does local business, is disadvantaged against somebody who's located in Delaware.
Yeah, so Jeffrey the giraffe gets to suck all the profits out of the state of
Pennsylvania.
Right,
and all you need is a mailbox in Delaware.
Yeah, through that magical box they've got there. It's magical, and I wish I could have a magical box.
Yeah.
And just scrubs my money clean.
So basically, you know, a little over 2 out of every 10 businesses are paying any corporate net income tax in Pennsylvania. And obviously we have a flat tax, so the wealthy are paying the same percentage of their income in taxes as the poor, which is 3.07%. And, you know, that's archaic. It's part of our state constitution. You know, I wish so much that the grassroots base of Occupy, which I'm part of, had as our number one goal in Pennsylvania to pass a graduated income tax so everybody paid a fair share.
I'm right there
then
with you.
Then we wouldn't have to cut higher ed costs.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And instead of having this Pavlovian response to tax increases, start talking about who, what, and where, what kind of taxes, what's the money going to go for, actually have an adult conversation other than this rabid anti-tax. And look, I understand it. It's been beat into us for 30 years. I've listened to conservative talk radio long enough to know, you know, where the red meat is, and that's where they put it.
Well, and they spend a lot of money to fire people up and believe that. And people advocate against their own interests because they're watching a TV commercial that says, I create jobs, don't tax me. And, you know, somehow they believe that. When, in fact, when you look at the distribution of taxpayers, it is not the top earners of America who are creating the most jobs. And people know that in their towns as well.
Yep.
The top earners are not the biggest employers. So, you know, common sense gets trumped by advertisement and, you know, lots and lots of hysteria.
And you look at our political discourse right now, it's all funded by the big billionaire class who they've got the money. I mean, I am just amazed at how many negative ads we're seeing and how much mud. And I'm happy it's happening to the Republicans right now. I'm glad they're beating up Romney over his Cayman Island money and his low in the 13.9 tax rate and Bain Capital. I'm thrilled at all of that. But at the end of the day, I don't know how all of that secret money, all of that big money helps our democracy.
Certainly, at the end of the day, as you know, in Pennsylvania, isn't, but we can go back to transportation here for a second. This budget cuts what's available to repair our roads and bridges. Now, it looks like they're going to hold bridges harmless and continue to do the bridge construction. They kind of have to because the Rendell administration put in a 6-year plan and it's debt financed and it's hard to break it. And that's why we did it that way, because we had no faith that the person leaving after us would continue to make progress on bridges. But, you know, you drive around this state between the damage that the Marcellus shale companies are causing and just the sheer wear and tear on our roads, to be cutting transportation spending when it's one of the biggest job creators we have. You could say that not taxing wealth people, I'm sorry, You could say that not taxing a rich person could hurt a job creator. There's no proof to that. The largest way that the federal government or the state government can promote job creation is to put contracts out for private companies to repair roads and bridges.
Yep. And I think it was the Republican from Ohio, Stephen LaTourette, who said that 42,000 jobs for every $1 billion in investment we make. So they understand it. They know it. Why aren't they doing it?
Right. Well, and especially in a day and age when your state budget is so weak, if you're not going to increase corporate taxes, you've got to increase the income of everybody else. And not only did they not increase corporate taxes, I hope your listeners understand, they cut corporate taxes in this budget, and they held individual taxes at the same rate that they're currently at. And so, therefore, the only way they could make up for the cut in corporate taxes and the relative stagnation in individual income taxes was to cut the hell out of the state budget.
And they sure did that. And what I've been telling people is, look, this is all the Tea Party people are screaming, Obama wants to redistribute wealth. Corbett just did.
Absolutely. And the thing is, Rick, for instance, in the cuts in the general assistance program, which is in welfare for single, very sick adults, you know, those people aren't going to disappear. Like, if you're sick, you don't just disappear. Now your county is going to have to find the resources to help you, or a hospital is going to have to give you care and not be reimbursed, which drives up the cost for you and me. And most of these people have very expensive medical care. They're cancer people. So the hospitals, you know, maybe they'll care for these folks, and then the rest of us will all pay the difference in our health insurance premiums. So on some level, you know, Corbett is, you know, socializing the cost of the uninsured among the, you know, 97% of the 99% who have insurance, you know?
Yeah, but then the question then becomes is, you know, aren't you really just pushing us back to the pay or die system? And because to be honest, that kind of a system, you're not going to get decent care, and you're talking about people dying.
Absolutely.
And it could be me.
It's dire. It will be dire for these individuals, and it's so inhumane, and it so doesn't reflect, as you point out, the year of the Bible. I mean, it's just sort of just flies in the face of any religious tradition to just the fact that we have uninsured people in America, but that this program, which the Corbett administration says it's going to save them, let's say, $100-150 million, and that's a lot of money, but the benefit of that is that we, at least all as human beings, can have greater comfort that we're living up to, you know, our obligation to our fellow man. I mean, I can see, okay, I might have to raise tuition for college, which I don't think they should be doing. But, you know, these are pretty vulnerable people.
Yeah, but the thing to me is, well, the first thing I said about this budget is it's very penny wise, pound foolish. We're going to save pennies here, but what's it going to cost me down the line? What are the costs, as you pointed out, that I didn't even think of in my health insurance premiums that now we're going to have to take care of more uninsured, because now that Corbett's here, they kicked 41,000 people off of adult basic, another 88,000 children off of CHIP. What do you do?
Right. Well, you know, you're right. It is a redistribution of wealth. I mean, the middle class will pay more to help ensure that the poor get some care. And the wealthy, you know, they're kind of exempt from that because they're not even in the realm of the communities where this is going to happen. My favorite part of this is it really goes to this class issue, which is you don't want to increase funding in infrastructure. In fact, you cut the amount of money for road repair, and you hold stable the amount of money for transit. But, you know, if you live in a gated community, your roads are taken care of. The rest of us, though, hey, we all live out here on these roads, and you're going to make them worse. It's just sort of every part of this, you know, drives up costs for the average Pennsylvanian, because a bad road means more car repairs, a road that is too small means more congestion, higher gas prices, and certainly it means that the goods coming to the stores that I shop in are going to be artificially inflated in their price to deal with the fact that there's bad roads in Pennsylvania. Not artificially, actually increased in prices.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm paying one way or the other if Corbett doesn't have the state government do its fair share.
Excellent point. That wasn't a shot at Romney, was it? Because, you know, Romney, you know, said not too long ago that he walks the same streets that the rest of us do. In his gated community. So I just wanted to make sure that wasn't a shot at poor Mittens.
No, I hadn't even thought about that. And I would hope that if his experience is like the rest of our experience, if he were to come to Washington, or certainly during his campaign, he ought to be saying what he's going to do about that, because the roads in America and the bridges in America are crumbling, and our water systems are crumbling, and the House appropriations under the Republican leadership is cutting transportation funding. The Senate, under Democratic leadership, is holding it level. We need to be spending much more than we're spending today just to keep pace. So we are going backwards in front of Mitt's eyes. So what's his plan?
Yeah, I think Thomas Friedman had the best statement on our infrastructure that I've heard. He said he had flown from Beijing to LAX, and it was like coming from the Jetsons to the Flintstones.
Yeah, so, how scary is that?
Yeah, we've got a lot of work to do. Donna Cooper, I appreciate the time. Thanks for your input on our wonderful governor's budget proposal and what it means. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick.
Always great talking with you. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
What a sight to watch Newt Gingrich campaign for president. If ego was gas, he'd be the Hindenburg blimp. Most politicians try to puff themselves up a bit, but Gingrich is wildly bloviating about his worthiness and levitating his character to incredulous heights. For example, he insists that he's not merely a right-wing political writer, strategist, and operative. No, no. Newt says he is a transformative thinker, even anointing himself as the, quote, leader, possibly, of the civilizing forces. In fairness, he has been quite transformative recently, brazenly transforming himself from a three-decade Washington insider and corporate hired gun into a born-again champion of outsiders who hate moneyed elites. That's some trick, since he's a moneyed elite, albeit a particularly grubby one. Having been unceremoniously scooted out of the House speakership in 1998 because of both corruption and ineptness, he promptly turned to influence peddling, making himself rich by trading on his Washington connections to get favors for numerous corporate clients. His 2010 income topped $3 million, and he enjoys a net worth of some $6.5 million, including a luxurious home in one of suburban Washington's swellest zip codes. And last year, he ran up a $50,000 tab on jewelry purchases at Tiffany, the ultimate gilder of moneyed elites. But to really get Gingrich's goat, call him a lobbyist. I was never a lobbyist, he snaps. Yeah, and Bill Clinton never had sex with that woman. What Newt means is he never registered as a lobbyist, but there he's been for more than a decade, openly selling himself as a doorman for corporations wanting access to the capital city's power centers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Newt's not transformative, not an outsider, and damn sure not presidential. He's just another old fraud.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Oh, what a wonderful world it would be. Yes, if we could just go back to the good old days with George W. Oh, the little shrub man himself.
There's an old saying in Tennessee. I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, but it says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, can't get fooled again.
I so miss him. Well, turns out Congressman John Fleming, Republican from Louisiana, fooled The Onion. I don't know if you remember this, but I do. About nine months ago, The Onion, they're a satirical newspaper. It's all funny, ha-ha, jokey stuff, made up. No reality whatsoever. It's kind of like the Borowitz Report that I read once in a while. Well, they came out with a story about Planned Parenthood wanting to build this $8 billion abortionplex. They would have, you know, shopping malls and movie theaters and nightclubs, huge, massive nightclubs, and just everything possible to tick off the radical right wing. So, and it did, man. It really got their engines going. And it was a joke. It had nothing to do with it. So this congressman evidently finally comes across this story and posts it on his Facebook page with the words, "More on Planned Parenthood, abortion by the wholesale." And somebody goes, "Hey, you do realize that The Onion is satire, right? How exactly did you get elected?" And that's a good question. And I've been telling people this, you know, I've met a lot of representatives and a lot of these congressmen. They're not the brightest bulbs in the box. They want a popularity contest, the most of them. Some of them very bright. Some of them, you know, very passionate. But some of them, like this guy, not the brightest bulb in the box, going to just pander and, you know, do whatever he needs to do to whip up the frenzy of the folks in his area to get him elected. And then he does dumb stuff like this. Maybe he will be. And, you know, I was thinking about this a little bit during the break. Maybe he, now that this woman, Karen Handel, has resigned as a vice president over at the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Group, maybe now she's resigned, maybe that's where they'll go after. Maybe they'll look to him to be their vice president for public policy. Good research there, John. Nice job. Again, 9 months old. And how can you read that and go, oh, yeah, there's something serious. There's something actual about that. Man, just really kind of funny. But it is what it is. And now you've got Mitt Romney. Mitzi couldn't stay out of it because I think Mitzi's kind of done the polling. Mitzi's jumped into it and said, well, you know, I'm a pro-life individual. I was a pro-life governor, served as a pro-life governor. I'm a pro-life candidate. And I'm going, really? I kind of remember you as candidate for governor, you know, running on choice. Just a thought. But he's now claiming, the anti-choice, anti-abortion. He's their guy now. And I look at the fact that most people you talk about, I think, get the contraception idea. Because understand all of this attack on abortion to begin with. That's just the first part of it. And as I've said before, I'm surprised that this Susan G. Komen for the Cure Group got involved in politics. And this is what happens when you go after right-wingers. People who, a lot of these folks we're now finding out were in the Bush administration. That woman, she ran for governor under the guise of, we're going to go after Planned Parenthood. And when they did, realized, oops, we've kind of ticked people off. Because people kind of like the idea that this group was nonpartisan. What they were doing is they were looking for a cure to a horrible disease that who can be against? And now you've put yourself right dead smack in the middle of this. And I truly believe it is going to bite them in the behind. And I was reading a story by this Sarah Posner. And she says she was listening to a conference call with the folks over at Public Policy Polling. And they were they're going through some of the results of the polling that they had done on behalf of Planned Parenthood on the question of this religious exemption. And, you know, they were going through the numbers, and the guy who had done it, this Tom Jensen, he said there's a potential of having a big impact in this election. This is now an election year issue. And in his opinion, this wasn't going to hurt Obama. This was going to hurt Romney because the Catholic votes, he's going to have to take a stand on contraception. And understand that the Catholics, in the most recent poll just taken, show that the majority of Catholics are in favor of contraception. The church, maybe not so much, but the Catholics, the actual people, they are. 58% think businesses should be required to provide health plans with free birth control. Now, put that in with the rest of the country, only 55% agree with that. The people who don't agree with it, the crazy right-wingers, the evangelical, the white evangelical Protestant. Not so much. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out, because I think it does. I think it bites Romney in the behind, because look, they're gonna make him take a stand on the abortion issue, which he's done. That's, as I've always said, that's the first step. That's the first domino. Then they want to go after Griswold. If they can go after birth control, that's the win, man. That's the end game. Get these women back where they belong. And I was talking about this with my producer the other day. I don't understand, and he agreed with me, how a woman today could look at the Republican Party and go, oh, yeah, that's who I'm going to vote for. I mean, I just don't get it. The attacks never stop. And there's part of me that goes, you know, this religious thing, I think, has clouded some people's judgments. You know, things that they think that they've been told, things that they know. Look, if you don't want to have an abortion, don't. Please don't. If you don't want to use birth control, don't. Not my problem whatsoever. But don't get out there in the public eye and say, oh, we need to do away with these things. It's kind of dumb. And it's going to be a huge issue, I think. I think Romney's going to be sorry he stepped in this one. And I think Susan G. Komen I think they're going to be sorry they stepped in this one as well. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the hell with.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Earth. Sky.
Somewhere around the planet there's going to be a tree falling, and that will not be replaced. We lose a football field's worth of forest every 4 seconds.
You're listening to satellite researcher Alan Bellward of the European Commission's Joint Research Center. He's talking about deforestation, where forests are cleared for land to grow crops or raise cattle. In 2011, Dr. Bellward was part of the most comprehensive forest survey ever, which involved over 190 countries. He told EarthSky that since 1990, the world has lost 180 million acres of forest.
Forests are an absolutely fundamental part of the climate system. I mean, deforestation accounts for about 12% of all anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide.
Anthropogenic changes are those caused by humans, and one key tool to seeing all changes to Earth's forests, said Bellward, is the U.S. Landsat program of satellites, which since 1972 have continuously and precisely monitored the world's forest cover. What's more, Landsat provides the data freely and openly to anyone in the world.
The Landsat provides us with a really quite detailed picture of the forest canopy. It's not just a photograph, it's actually measuring light outside the range of sensitivity of the human eye. And we're able to pick up subtle changes in the forest canopy.
EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there for your entertainment, enjoyment, convenience. Smartphone, Stitcher app, make sure you take it with you. Let's find out what's going on around the nation and around the world. I've got Justin Duckham on the line, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So we find out that the president is now going to back super PACs. Is that right?
Yes, that is the case. Last night, his campaign manager sent out an email saying that the administration was going, or that the campaign team was going to bow to the political pressures of 2012. And support Priorities USA, which is a pro-Obama super PAC.
Well, he doesn't really have a choice. In my opinion, there's no choice there for him. Because it's like going into a gunfight carrying a knife, not working.
Exactly. And that's what the campaign tried to express. They tried to say that by refusing to support a super PAC, they were essentially disarming themselves and leaving themselves vulnerable to the juggernaut that was Mitt Romney's super PAC. However, despite trying to put the best face on this, this has still been a pretty big hot button issue with those on the left and the right.
Oh no, I hate it. I hate the whole super PAC idea. We need to get money out of politics. We need to undo Citizens United. But here's the thing. I'm cognizant of the fact that if he doesn't, he's going to get his behind whooped.
That's true. And, you know, the administration is also trying to emphasize today that just because they're going to be kind of joining the evil league of super PACs, that doesn't really mean that they're going to let their guard down and no longer try to find ways to mitigate the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling. And that is something that Carney was just saying today to a pretty skeptical press room. So look, we'll see how that moves forward. But,
yeah, we'll see how it goes. But at the end of the day, in this political climate, if you can't raise money, you look at all of the cash that's been spent on radio and television, if you can't get out there, you can't get your message out, you can't win. Like I said, I hate it. It is what it is, and it's the only way. It's the way our political system is right now. Now, I wish people would change it. I wish people would pledge that, you know what, after this election, we're going to fix this, and it's never going to be like this again. But I doubt that's going to happen either.
And, you know, the administration has also said that they're going to be doing this in the most ethical way possible. You know, for example, they will be disclosing all of their recipients. They also promised that while some high-level members of the campaign staff may make appearances for Priorities USA, neither Joe Biden, Michelle Obama, or the president himself will actually be stumping for them, which is you know, more than a lot of campaigns can say.
Right, and the part that I think is important that people need to hear is they're going to disclose, and that's the part. Look, you know, if you can make the argument that money is speech, as long as I know who's saying it, and that's where part of my belief is. I want to know who's behind all of these attack ads. In Florida, the number I saw was 92% of all of the ads put out by these super PACs were negative. I want to know who's behind them.
No, that's true, and it looks like we are going to have an insight into that today.
Good.
And that is a promise that Priorities USA has made to the administration, or else I don't think we would have seen this announcement.
Good, good. Out in California, what's going on? What's with the gay issue?
The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 2-1 today that a lower court judge was correct when declaring Prop 8 was unconstitutional. You know, as you know, Prop 8 was the controversial ballot referendum that was passed in the Golden State back in 2008 that essentially outlawed gay marriage in the state after an executive order from Governor Schwarzenegger said otherwise. And right now this is being interpreted as a step forward for the entire issue toward the Supreme Court. And there are a lot of people speculating right now that that may go before the nine judges sometime within the next year.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. Because I got to be honest, I don't see why it's that big of a deal. I don't see how anyone else getting married has any effect on my life whatsoever. It's mind blowing that anyone would care what consenting adults are doing with their lives. I mean, it just blows my mind.
No, that's true, but you know, still there is a huge legal operation by those who. Who apparently do care what than their own married lives. So it's an issue that's not going away, despite you know, a lot of people's wishes to the other to the contrary.
Yeah, well, what they need to do is get a life. Because worrying about what other people do, maybe you should fix your own problems. Like my grandfather always said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. And I feel the same way about those folks. You know, I quick story. I had a friend and he was kind of a friend. A guy I used to work with, we used to go up to Massachusetts and stay in a hotel. I drove a truck for a living. And he saw on TV that they were talking about this issue, and he was just so angry that gays would get married and it was going to ruin the sanctity of his marriage. Yet, he didn't have any problem with meeting his girlfriend and her child, or both of their child, up in Massachusetts and staying with her for the evening and then returning to his wife and children in Pennsylvania. That wasn't a problem, and that wasn't going to harm his marriage whatsoever. But those gay people, that was just going to undo it.
You know, there certainly is some cognitive dissonance there. That's just kind of shocking.
That's just nuts is what it is. Lastly, caucus night tonight. Rick Santorum may have a shot. Could this be Santorum Tuesday? Could this be Revival Tuesday?
You know, this really is his last chance. You know, he's going in this sort of using the same language that John Huntsman used before New Hampshire and that Rudy Giuliani used before going into Florida, which is this is their moment to shine, and if they don't do it, then they're probably not going to have another chance. It's looking like, you know, Santorum may pick up Minnesota, may pick up Missouri, both states which are, as of a few days ago, favored for Romney, and may pull second place in Colorado, which would be exactly what his campaign needs in order to stay competitive, but could also, after all of, this expectation that's been building up around him, be the final blow for his candidacy.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I don't even know. I have no idea. Like, I'm from Pennsylvania. I have no idea why anyone would vote for him.
I mean, right now, that's a good question. And he still believes that he can be the most viable anti-Romney at the end of the day, which, makes sense in a certain light since he has less baggage than Newt Gingrich by quite a bit.
yeah,
but
right?
It's sort of unrealistic at this point. He hasn't won any of the major races, and I'm not convinced that Newt Gingrich's delegates will ultimately go for him if Gingrich somehow does bow out.
Yeah.
So, it looks like he has something else to prove at this point, or just may want to be the thorn in the side for Gingrich.
Or he's just, in it for another free sweater. I don't know.
Well, sweater vest. Come on,
sweater vest. There you go. Because he did visit the place where they make them over the weekend, so I'm sure they gave him one free.
Oh, I hope so.
Justin Duckham, I appreciate the time. Always great talk with you. I appreciate it.
Hey, you have a good one.
And, you look at this, and look, tonight, the caucuses are going to make their decisions. And, I'm hoping Rick gets a little boost. I really am, because I want the game to be played a little longer. I'm hoping more shots at Romney. I'm still hoping the investigation of the Swiss banks turns up some more money from Romney hiding over there. That would be a wonderful October surprise. And understand, it's possible. The Justice Department right now is investigating 11 of those banks. The Swiss have given us an encrypted list of all of the Americans who have money in their system. Think about what that means. They have given us a list of everybody. But all we have to do to get the secret decoder ring is tell them that we're not going to hold them liable. We're going to hold them harmless. They'll be fine. They can walk away. Because this is what rich people do. They sell the guy down below. So the big bankers are going, well, sorry, all of you people. You're below us. We're going to sell you off. And I'm hoping they do it. It'll be interesting. And I hope they make it public. All of the people who are hiding money over there and have been for years. It would be nice to know, and I know we'll never get the records, but it would be nice to know exactly how much education, how much health care, how much investment in our roads and our bridges and our infrastructure was lost because of the Romney class hiding money over in Swiss banks. That would be something nice to know. It would be kind of interesting. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
And take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down.
Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
One of Newt Gingrich's aides, just get on your knees, I guess. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So, Newtie evidently likes technology. In fact, well, it doesn't love him back. But here's the thing. One of his campaign people decided it would be a good idea to go to the Newtie webpage and, well, just make some improvements. They went and cut, dozens of edits into this. They did away with the infidelity. They did away with the credit line. You know, anything that was may have looked a little bad, they decided, well, didn't need to be there because, you know, we needed to rediscover good in America. And, you know, I go back to when I was in high school and we read the book 1984. You know, and I remember at the time thinking, man, what a world that would be. How horrible would that be that you could trust almost nothing because everything would be edited and everything would be instant? Yeah, we're almost living that. So history, evidently, now we can just edit it. Didn't happen. So, well, I don't know. Anyway, yesterday we talked about the Indiana Republican Secretary of State, Charlie White, who was convicted on 6 felony counts of voter fraud, theft, and, of course, perjury. Then he was booted out of office. Like I said, then he was all ticked off and said that, you know, Mitch Daniels, he did the same thing. He committed the same kind of crime for the last 10 straight elections. So not happy. The Republicans in Maine have decided, well, we better slow the roll on this whole voter suppression thing. We better kind of maybe rethink what we're doing on the voter ID bill, and they have failed to pass it for a second time. And look, at the end of the day, you know, when you start passing these kind of laws, eventually they turn around, and they bite you in the behind. When we were going through the budget today, my producer pointed out that next year, evidently, the state of Pennsylvania is going to allocate, and I forget how much money it was. The people over at the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center said it's going to cost about $11 million to implement this voter suppression bill. So, you know, we're cutting education, we're cutting vital social service programs, we're, you know,
just slash cut, cut, and punish. But we've got money for photo IDs to solve a problem that no one can show to me exists. It's kind of dumb. You want to talk about waste, fraud, and abuse? You want to talk about wasteful spending? That is it. And I look at these block grants. This is just a haven for waste, fraud, and abuse, in my opinion. Wait till you start seeing the school districts struggling even more than they are now. Wait till you start seeing the private charter schools, sucking all the assets out of the local school districts. We've heard about the big one, Chester Upland. But Spike called in today, Pocono Mountain up in the Poconos, which is a fairly affluent school district, which is why I was kind of stunned when he said, you've got this mega church, which is big up there, this mega church charter school, that's sucking all the money out of that district. It was one of the more affluent school districts in the state, what I remember 10 years ago. So look how quickly it's happened. It's just amazing. And you look at this frame that we're broke, and Andy sent me an email saying we're not broke. Corporations are making more money than ever. The key word being more than ever. He said corporate profits are at record highs, especially when you look at it as in a proportion of profits to GDP. And he pointed out a couple of articles in the Financial Times and the New York Times, basically pointing it out. Wage and salary incomes as a percentage of GDP in 2011 compared to 1980, we've actually lost 5%. So what does that mean? That means, 5% didn't go to us. So 44% is what we got, down from 49% in 1980. So you're seeing that redistribution of wealth, that money that used to come to workers and wages and salary and other and benefits going to profits. And then you look at the percentage of after-tax profits as a percentage of GDP. Back then it was less than 5%. Today it's more than 10%. Again, where'd that money go? Came out of our pockets, went to theirs. And they said, he points out wages as a percentage of the national income. We've actually seen it go down 10% from 86 down from 68 down to 58. And again, look at the corporate profits. It was 27, now it's 37. So you're seeing a direct correlation between what we used to get, the distribution of the pie as we used to take from it, and now what it is. During the Bush years, they kept talking about, we need to make the pie higher, which, I always took as, out of the reach of the working person. And what he meant was, we need to make it bigger. Well, that doesn't happen. And it doesn't matter how big you make the pie. If my slice is only 1% of the pie, sorry, not helping me. And you talk about this stuff, and it seems to be lost on some folks. Especially my Tea Party friends. Who keep pushing that frame. But Rick, we're broke. We don't have any money. But we've got money to give corporations. We can fund tax breaks for natural gas refineries, or not tax the people taking the resources out from under our feet, really? And we can afford to clean up their mess? We can afford to build the roads for them? Really? Is that what we can do? It's just kind of mind-blowing. And we're actually talking about putting, at a time when the Occupy movement has really done a fantastic job of highlighting wealth inequality and a lot of the problems that I've been talking about for years, we're actually, as a nation, considering putting the poster child of the 1% into the White House. Are we really doing that? Unfortunately, I think a lot of folks are, the more, and I've heard this a number of times, and the polling numbers have kind of come out on this side, the more they learn about Romney, the more they realize they don't like him, which is why he's not answering any more questions, and why you're never going to, once this is done, you're not going to see him out doing public events unless it is really well vetted. But some of the polling numbers, they ask the question, regardless of whom you support, which candidate do you trust better to do a job? Is it Romney or Obama protecting the middle class? Obama's got a 56-37 lead. So he's well ahead. handling international affairs. You know, 55% of the folks say, you know, Obama's done a good job. That's who I trust. Romney down to 38. And you go down the list, you know, fighting terrorism, handling taxes, creating jobs. Romney doesn't have an advantage in any of those. Now, 50% of the people say that Romney would handle the economy better, which I don't agree with, and that he would handle the federal budget deficit better, which, again, I don't agree with. Because what he's talking about doing is more of the same. Cutting taxes on the top, cutting corporate taxes, making sure that the folks at the top are well taken care of, while you and I, we get less service, we get less opportunity, less health care, less education, less infrastructure. So we're the ones struggling and suffering here. Understand, you know, I'm just telling you what the realities are. The righties will go screaming through the roof, oh, well, you're talking about class warfare. Yeah, because that's what's going on. In 10, 15, 20 years, if we continue down the path that we're on, which is completely walking away from investing in our infrastructure, that five-year plan that the Republicans have put forth in the House, again, it comes back down to being on terrestrial radio or you know, just talking to people on the street, is absolutely freaking stupid. Just plain dumb. You know, it's like if you own a house and there's a hole in the roof and you're saying, well, you know what? I got to pay my credit card bill. I got to pay off my credit card bill. I'm just going to leave the hole in the roof. And you keep paying, the hole gets worse and worse and worse until eventually the whole house collapses. That's the path we're following. The path we're following is completely divesting from any improvements in our nation. We are living off investments that are 20, 30, 50, 80 years old. And the governor in his speech today didn't lay out a clear plan for his transportation idea. Nothing. He said, oh, we'll just talk about it. Well, it didn't occur overnight. We're not going to solve it overnight, so well, heck with it. Is that the vision that we're looking for? I sure hope not. And the vision that the Romneys of the world have for us is what? Well, pander to the job creators, whatever that means. A guy whose view of the economy is, let's suck all the resource out of something and then cut it off to die onto the backs of the taxpayers. And I'm thrilled, and I can't wait till Obama and his machine gets after this Bain Capital stuff. Because you haven't heard anything yet. And maybe Newt Gingrich did the best thing for the party that he could have done. And I'm glad he didn't do it well. I'm glad he didn't do it well enough to take Romney down. Because it's all out there now. We now know. Now we get to know all of the gruesome details. And I'll tell you, we're going to see people who have lost their homes, their lives, their retirement because of the Romneys and the Bain Capitals and all of these vulture capitalist groups who have been sucking this country dry for years. I'm hoping we see all of that. And then maybe we can make that clear decision that has to be made. We can't continue to stay in the middle. We can't continue to vacillate between one idea and the next, which is why I think I have to stick with Obama in this, because he's right. We are heading in a recovery direction. Now is not the time to be changing ships. A lot of things I'm not happy about with him, and I'll be focusing on those as well and pushing and trying to get him to go the right way. But at the end of the day, Romney, not the answer. Santorum, really not the answer. Gingrich, well, he was never the answer. And Ron Paul just makes me laugh at this point. He's just a chucklehead. Anyway, I hope you have a great night. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial.